in Michigan. To book your time, call Midwest Studios at 248-844-8010. That's 248-844-8010. Get on over there and check them out or go online at MidwestStudios.net.
WRIF Detroit presents Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show with Peter Werby. To express your opinion, call 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everybody. Thanks for joining me all throughout the Detroit area, southeastern Michigan. What part of Ontario is this? Northern Ohio. Let me see. Southwestern Ontario, that's right. And those of you listening all around the world and all across the country on the World Wide Web, either www.wrif.com or www.radiopower.org as well. And you can find out all the different ways that this show can be accessed, including archives at whiterosesociety.org, just by going to my website, peterwerby.com. Last name's W-E-R-B-E, peterwerby.com. And click on the air, and it'll tell you all the different times the show is rebroadcast, where it's archived, all of that. I told Dave, an Oakland County sheriff, I'd give him a shout-out. This was kind of a funny story. A little earlier, I was here on other business about 9 o'clock, and I was leaving, and I saw an Oakland County sheriff's car trying to get in. I mean, in other words, trying to figure out how does he get through this massive security of the WRIF compound, right? And so I said, can I help you? And he said, I'm trying to get into WRIF. This is Deputy Dave. And I'm probably shouldn't give his last name, even though he gave it to me. And I said, well, I can let you in, but I don't know how you're going to get out, because you got to have this card, right, that reads it, one of those new deals, just flash it at this little laser beam, and then it lets you in. So I could have got him in. I said, do you know anybody in there? I wondered why he was going in. I figured maybe he knew Chafee or somebody like that, Motor City Riffs. And he said, no, I'm looking for Peter Werby. So I didn't think he was coming to make an arrest, so I simply said, well, I'm Peter Werby. And he says, oh, man, I was coming to see you. I don't really know why he was coming 2 hours before the show, but that was cool. Sometimes a lot of people, their listeners think we get here very, 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 very early, before our show. They don't know we come in like 3 minutes before. I came in earlier than that. Anyway, so I said, well, what's up? And so he said that he'd been listening to me. He was a teenager. And he said 80% of the time he didn't agree with me. I said, well, that's fine. I thought it was kind of cool. He agreed with me 20% of the time at least. And he said he had voted for Bush in 2000, but he wasn't going to vote for Bush this time. So I said, you can vote for Nader? I don't even know why I said that. I didn't ask him the obvious. And he said, no, isn't that kind of just a wasted vote? I said, well, it is if you want to get out, if you want to get Bush out of office, that's for sure. So I think what we're looking at here is this mammoth sea change in attitudes in this country. Now, the polls, which show Kerry slightly ahead, don't even demonstrate what's going on. There is so many new voters, so many people they call occasional voters, people that say don't vote regularly, that I think the polls are going to be jammed. A friend of mine just emailed me and said, "Why?" I wrote and said that I just sent in an absentee ballot. And they wrote back and they said, aren't you going to be in town on November 2nd? And I said, no, I don't want to be in that huge line, because the lines are going to be tremendous. This is going to blow George W. Bush right out of office, back to Crawford, Texas, or up to Connecticut, where he really is from. So there was a debate, another one, a little bit more of the imploding and unraveling of George W. Bush. Why does this guy take an anger management course? He never has anybody confronting him directly like that. He's surrounded by yes men. He has when he has a rally, you got to almost sign a loyalty oath to get in. So, any impressions of that last debate in St. Louis at American University? Be interested to hear what you have to say. 313-298-WRIF. We asked last week just for conservatives to call in, because most of the people that call here, callers usually reflect the host's political views. I mean, you rarely ever get like 50-50 for callers, although I'm surprised how many conservatives are willing to listen, at least. I mean, most people don't listen to people they don't agree with. So hats off to you if you don't agree with me and you're listening. 313-298-WRIF. Who won? I would say Kerry, hands down. Everybody, I think, says that. Bush debating skills, not too good. Which brings into question this the Bush bulge mystery. The bulge. You've heard this? There's this big bulge in his suit jacket right between his shoulder blades that you can see in the photographs when he's shown from the back during the first debate. In fact, according to this account, a mysterious bulge under U.S. President George W. Bush's suit jacket during his first debate with Democratic rival John Kerry drew the attention of two top U.S. newspapers after days of feverish internet speculation. The Bush campaign dismissed the mystery bulge as nothing more than a wrinkle in the presidential jacket and derided speculation that Bush may have been wired as nothing more than ridiculous speculation of internet conspiracy nuts. Well, I would invite you to look at this photograph. You can go to my site. Again, peterwerbe.com, W-E-R-B-E.com. It's not right on the front page there. Or you can go to commondreams.org and look for the article called Bush Bulge Mystery, Wire or Wrinkle. Now, I wonder how many of you have seen this and what your opinion is. It certainly looks like something is under his coat. Let me see here. I had this little article from the New York Times where there was speculation about that, and they had his tailor. Let me see. Is this the one that has his tailor in now? Nicole Devenish, the Bush campaign's communications director, said it was most likely a rumpling of that portion of his suit jacket or a wrinkle in the fabric. Well, it certainly doesn't look like that. He's hunched over. I don't know what's happened to his good posture. I mean, he's all kind of gnarled up and everything like that. I don't think he's doing well with this, with these debates particularly. But this is all wearing on. A lot of speculation. He's on antidepressants, and he really needs an anger management course. That's for certain. But anyways, you can see this rectangular bulge with the short side running across his back, and then I'll be damned if that doesn't look like a wire going over his shoulder. Now, the first thing I thought, it's another one of these stage photos. You've seen all those ones of Bush on the internet where he's got the binoculars backwards, he's reading books upside down and what have you. All of those are frauds. All of those are Photoshop, a computer program where you can alter stuff very easily. But this is taken right off of the television. Now, I don't know. I mean, I usually think the worst of Bush and all of his cronies. But a couple of things strike me, and maybe some of you folks that have some experience with electronics or what have you. You don't need something as a receiver that would be 6 inches long and 3 inches wide, right? No, you wouldn't need that. And this wire going up over his shoulder, it's all wireless now. But I don't know. What do you think? I mean, I saw one article, which is available on my website, where one of his, his translators into when he was in Indonesia, that Bush was using a wire, and he was getting all this information of what to say about Indonesian politics. And the translator was absolutely stunned because he said Bush was spouting out stuff that he, the translator, didn't know. Now, Bush is not engaged. Bush does not know anything about Indonesian politics. So, I thought some of the really loony answers, because this is a man that cannot think on his feet. The New York Times says Bush was deeply unpersuasive when asked why he had not permitted the importation of cheaper prescription drugs from Canada. He claimed that the reason was, quote, "I want to make sure it cures you and doesn't kill you." Now, this is insane. A lot of these drugs are U.S. drugs that have gone to Canada and then are re-imported at cheaper rates. So it's obviously the ones coming from American drug companies. But even if they're manufactured in Canada, I mean, is it like Bangladesh? I mean, it really doesn't make any sense to those of us that live in the Detroit area, where you can just go a few miles and you're in Canada. Anyways, Kerry said that 4 years ago in the campaign debate, Bush had said that importing medicine from Canada sounded like a real good idea. So who's flip-flopping? I mean, Bush is a master flip-flopper. I think most of us know that. Well, tomorrow, October 11th, is Columbus Day, celebrated as this great feat of navigation and courage and what have you, sort of the you know, the capacity of the human spirit to burst beyond its current boundaries and what have you. And there's a book I've always been very influenced by called Beyond Geography, Beyond Geography by Frederick Turner. Not the guy from the 1890s about the frontier, but a current contemporary writer. Now, Europe in 1492 was a mess, terrible shape, awful. It was a pathogen, it was pathogenic to human beings in every regard. Every government was an authoritarian government, mostly all royalty. In fact, maybe completely all royalist governments. No democracy whatsoever. Religious fanaticism dominated everywhere. In fact, you know, there was all these expressions of almost religious madness. Constant wars. Europe was in this constant state of warfare that just devastated entire regions. They had environmentally devastated the entire continent of Europe, particularly Western Europe, virtually deforesting it for fuel and for building. There was constant epidemics, you know, plagues and rampant madness. And then Columbus set off for the New World. Motivated by what? Greed, essentially. Looking for gold, new way to the, find a new path to the, a new route, right, to the New World. In People's History of the United States, 1492 to the present, Howard Zinn writes, I think, cogently about his arrival, Columbus's arrival. Howard Zinn's book, A People's History of the United States, is the only history book in our history to ever have sold a million copies. First chapter is called Columbus, the Indians, and Human Progress. Here's just a few sentences from it. Arawak. Now, these were the Indians of the of what we call the West Indies. Arawak men and women, naked, tawny, and full of wonder, emerged from their villages onto the island's beaches and swam out to get a closer look at the strange big boat. When Columbus and his sailors came ashore carrying swords, speaking oddly, the Arawaks ran to greet them, brought them food, water, and gifts. Columbus later wrote of this in his log. This is what Columbus is writing after the first evening, after being greeted by these wonderful, happy, welcoming people. The Arawak brought us parrots and balls of cotton, spears, and many other things which they exchanged for the glass beads and hawk's bells. They willingly traded everything they owned. They were well built with good bodies and handsome features. They do not bear arms and do not know them, for I showed them a sword. They took it by the edge and cut themselves out of ignorance. They have no iron. Their spears are made of cane. They would make fine servants. This is what Columbus writes to these people who welcomed him to the New World. They would make fine servants. With 50 men, we could subjugate them all and make them do whatever we want. They would make fine servants. This is Columbus. I don't think I'm going to celebrate Columbus Day. Michael Moore, the Republicans want him arrested. They've asked Michigan prosecutors to bring charges against Michael Moore. Have you heard about this? Here's what Michael writes. You may have heard by now that the Michigan Republican Party has called for my arrest. That's right. They literally want me brought up on charges and hope that I'm locked up. Michael says, I'm not kidding. Republican Party yesterday filed a criminal complaint with the prosecutors in each of the counties where I spoke last week in Michigan. And you know what the charges are? Vote buying. They're accusing Michael Moore. He says, my crime? Clean underwear for anyone who will vote in the upcoming elections. There's a law that says that you cannot... trying to look around for this. He does this. He's on the 60-city slacker uprising tour through the 20 battleground states, although he has pneumonia now. He took 3 days off. He's still going at it, even with pneumonia. He was in Nashville Friday night. 7,000 people came out to hear him. These people are voting. These are the people that aren't being counted in the polls. But Karl Rove, Dick Cheney, and the rest of this criminal gang in Washington know this. So the question is, As it stands now, they're going down the road to defeat. They're not going to allow this. What is going to be the October surprise is what we're all wondering. And Michael Morris says, I've been registering hundreds and on some nights thousands of voters at my arena and stadium events. I then ask her, everyone over 23 who has never, 23 who has never voted or didn't vote in the last election to stand up. I tell these slackers that I understand and respect why they think politicians are not worth the bother. I tell them that they may have been the original slacker and I don't want to change their slacker ways. And he goes on and on about that. If they promise me they'll vote, that they'll do this, I give the guys a three-pack of new Fruit of the Loom underwear. Because, you know, slackers don't wash their underwear at college. And the women get a day's supply of ramen noodles, the substance of slackers everywhere. So it seems to have worked, as each night the volunteer tables are swamped afterwards with hundreds of new and young voters signing up to campaign for regime change for the next 4 weeks. The satire of all this seems to be lost on the Republicans. Maybe it hasn't. The state of Michigan, where we spent most of last week, reported that over 100,000 young people recently registered to vote, a record that no one saw coming. The slacker tour has turned into a huge steamroller with a momentum of its own. And so, are these Republicans nuts? I don't mean that they're trying to stop Michael Moore, because their whole idea is to suppress the vote. The less people that vote, the better chance George Bush has. But this just gives him more publicity. Headline in the Detroit Free Press says, State GOP says Michael Moore illegally offered underwear in exchange for voting. Boy, these people, man, they are something else. All right, so three things. Columbus Day, I'm not celebrating it. Europe should have stayed where it was and solved its problems rather than taking this pathogenic culture and exporting it to the other parts of the world. It has been a disaster wherever it has touched. And what we see everywhere in the world today, from Asia to Latin America to Africa, is because Europe exploded beyond its own geography and failed. And then we're able to solve its problems by exploiting the other regions. Here in this hemisphere, as we know, 30 million native people paid the cost of Columbus's being discovered by the Arawaks. An inferior culture met a superior culture, and Columbus was too stupid to realize that the Arawak Indians who welcomed him had the solution to Europe's problems. That the Arawaks knew how to live on the land, with the land. They knew how to live peacefully, something the Europeans were at a loss. So maybe we ought to have an Arawak Day or something like that. Your thoughts, please, 313-298-WRIF, calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Any thoughts on Bush being wired? What, did he have a little gizmo on him? Would that even be necessary with today's technology? Would he dare to do it? On the other hand, would he dare to be out there, clueless as this man is, absolutely saying these incoherent sentences? Right? And Michael Moore, his arrest called for by the state GOP, the grand old party. What do we used to call it? The greedy oil people. Right, and some other ones like that as well. Dan Letarski, our producer and phone screener for the night, say hello to him. If you get mad at me, don't get mad at him. All right, he can take it. Hi, WRIF, you're on the air. Good evening.
Hello, how are you doing tonight?
Doing good. Thanks for joining us.
Good. I told your producer or whatever, you know, anybody who votes for John Kerry really makes me sick.
Makes you sick? How come?
Well, I mean, the whole flip-flop issue, that's not even a big deal.
Well, because actually Bush flip-flops more than Kerry, obviously.
They all do.
Right, okay.
They all do.
I mean, gotcha.
Okay. But what really bothers me is his lack of participation in the House of Senate, him and Edwards both.
What do you mean?
How can we count on this guy to be president?
You mean his attendance record since he's been running for the presidency?
No, I mean his attendance record in the 19 years he's been in the Senate.
He hasn't had a good record, huh?
No, he hasn't, and that bothers me. I mean, if he's going to be the president of the United States, where is he going to be at? What's he going to do?
Well, actually, I don't know his record. Can you tell us that?
Well, can you prove to me what he has done in the 19 years besides voting against our weaponry. You know?
I mean, he voted against the same weaponry that Dick Cheney voted against, so we know that. But why does it make you sick? I mean, I can understand that if you thought somebody wasn't performing well, and that might be an indication of how he would perform in another office, but why does it make you sick?
Well, okay, I'm looking at a quote right now that he said, okay?
Yeah.
We know we can't count on the French. We know we can't count on the Russians, said Mr. Kerry. We know that the Iraq is a danger to the United States, and we reserve the right to take preemptive action whenever we feel it's in our national interest.
Right.
That was on CNN Crossfire 1997.
Yeah, so?
Yeah, so? I mean, he wants to build a stronger coalition.
Yeah.
How's he going to do that? I mean, he's...
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think he's way off base. I mean, listen, finally, after spending a couple cool $1 billion of our taxpayers' money, they've came to the conclusion that great numbers of us knew all along that there were no weapons of mass destruction. The London Independent says, now we finally know what we had long suspected. When U.S. and British forces invaded Iraq, Saddam Hussein had no chemical weapons, he had no biological weapons, he had no nuclear weapons. In fact, he had no banned weapons at all. That is the considered judgment of the Iraq Survey Group set up by Bush to prove his case for removing the Iraqi dictators. So, when Kerry voted for the war resolution, he knew that Saddam Hussein didn't have any weapons of mass destruction. John Edwards knew that. Hillary Clinton knew that. They were voting very strategically, very politically, figuring that this guy is this cowboy that's going off on this very calculated maneuver to gain popularity on one hand and to create a beachhead for an imperial beachhead to control oil in the Middle East. And they didn't want to be the ones that... So, somebody like our senators from Michigan who voted against the war resolution, Stabenow and Levin, they too knew there were no weapons of mass destruction. But nobody wanted to say the emperor didn't have any clothes. Well, it turned out the emperor didn't have any clothes. I didn't have to spend $1 billion. They could have given me like $100 million, and I would have told them Saddam Hussein didn't have any weapons of mass destruction. And I said it. I said, Bush is lying in July 2002, and I've been saying that for over 2 years now. And I don't know why we had to spend a couple $1 billion of taxpayer money to prove what everyone knew. All right. Thank you. Appreciate your call. Thank you. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hi, Peter. My name is Jeff. How are you?
Hi, Jeff. I'm good.
Yeah, I just want to know if anybody out there in your audience or yourself, perhaps, might have watched the History Channel last night. There was a two-hour special called Soldiers for Hire.
Really? No, I didn't see it.
Okay, it was really interesting. It started out by saying that right now, I'm surprised they actually mentioned this, but... there are 20,000 mercenaries fighting for the United States with our coalition.
Uh-huh.
They're being paid by the head. Basically, they're bounty hunters.
And they're making a ton more money than U.S. soldiers.
Yes, and they're fighting right next to them. They're not only in this conflict, but they were with the first Bush in Desert Storm, and the reason, and then Kerry keeps bringing this up, that Tommy Franks and our soldiers ran off and left without the supplies. It wasn't the supplies they were waiting for, it was the mercs, the mercenaries.
Mm-hmm.
So actually this thing is a lot more under control than people think. They're getting their wires together, they're communicating more now with our troops, and my son, quite frankly, just graduated out of boot camp in the Air Force, so he's actually going to be doing it the soldier way, if you will. A lot of the people that, unfortunately, we've been seeing being beheaded on TV, I've never been to the website myself, and I won't.
Well, I would say I don't think we need to see that. I don't.
Right. But a lot of the people that they're catching that are being called civilians, quite frankly, it was coming out that some of these people are mercs, are mercenaries.
Well, some of them we know were just truck drivers that deal had gone down here in the United States because of the Bush economy, that they thought they could go over there and make some quick dollars.
Correct. But that's what they're telling you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's what this all came out again on this show, and if my phone quits, I'm on a cordless, so I'm going to run to the other one, okay?
Well, we got to finish this up kind of quickly anyway, so give me your final thoughts on it.
Well, Bush knows that this is going on because he activated them just after 9/11, 20,000 people. 20,000 ex-SEALs.
Right, there's tons of them over there.
Special Forces, they're over there. Kerry knows they're there. The other first Bush knows they're there.
But what? I don't understand the point. I mean,
well, Kerry keeps bringing up about how Bush is failing.
Yeah.
Bush can't mention in public about these mercenaries because it's not worldwide popular. But yet he does have a plan. He just can't mention it.
Oh, I think you're dreaming that he has a plan. He has no plan. Kerry has no plan. It's a morass. It's a quagmire. In fact, I think I'm going to go so far as to say when Kerry wins, I'll be damned if he is going to be able to successfully do any better than Bush can. Because Kerry's going to go over to some other countries and say, gee, I wonder if you could send your troops in here or give us some money or something like that. I don't think it's going to work. And the only thing, in fact, win or lose, Bush is going to launch this absolutely ferocious attack on the Iraqi cities that are being held by people that don't want to be occupied by the United States or may want an Islamic Republic or something like that. The people that are called the enemy, in other words, Iraqis that don't want either the U.S. occupying their country, nor do they want this puppet government installed by these foreign invaders. Gee. What strange people. George Bush himself said he would not like to be occupied. Yeah. All right. Thank you. Jeff. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air.
Hey, Peter. First time caller here.
Welcome.
Hey, I was listening to you a little bit earlier, you know, talking about the debate and everything. I happened to catch that, and I don't know, it was my view that they were kind of both about equal.
Mm-hmm.
But Bush did not seem to answer the question. You know, when he got cornered, he would get upset, have that little stupid Bush snicker of his.
Well, why do you think it's equal then?
Yeah, and
no, why do you think it's equal if he didn't have the answer?
I didn't really hear Kerry give a lot of answers either, and I'm definitely, you know, I'm going to vote for Kerry because I definitely don't want W in the House anymore. But I really didn't see Kerry come out with anything major in this debate.
Oh, he doesn't. I don't. All of this is carefully scripted, and the Democratic Party platform is pretty intricate, and you can go to johnkerry.com and find that all out. But this is all playing. If you think about this, these debates are playing for the few percentage of people that are undecided, and I guess probably to mobilize the base of each side. Except, Bush, he's a deer in the headlights. He doesn't know that.
I got the chance the other night. I had not seen Fahrenheit 9/11 until last night. Talk about a deer in the headlights. They showed that little film clip where he was sitting in the schoolhouse.
Right.
He found out that the second plane had hit the World Trade Center. And I could not believe that moron sat there for, I think it was 14 minutes, with this blank look on his face and decided to read a children's book rather than react.
He didn't know what to do.
Right. Nobody was there telling him what to do, so I guess it was just better to read a book.
Well, for those people that are my pet goat, or the pet goat, I think it turns out to be. That's the only mistake in Michael Moore's movie, the only factual mistake. It's not my pet goat, it's the pet goat. He admits to that. In terms of leadership, there's no way that John Kerry could be worse than George W. Bush. 9/11 happened under his watch. And people say, well, you know, Clinton, in September 11, 2001, there wasn't anybody named Clinton sitting in the White House. There wasn't anybody he wasn't in the White House, was he? There wasn't anybody named Clinton or anyone else that had taken the whole month of August off after he had just received a very specific warning that Al-Qaeda was about to strike in the United States. So it's very it's very unlikely that Kerry could be any worse. And it's also those leadership qualities, to some extent, are overrated. I don't mean entirely, but you are surrounded by experts. and the experts, and I put that in quotes, that have surrounded George W. Bush have failed at every turn. They're the ones that said we'd be welcome as liberators into Baghdad. They're the ones that said there were weapons of mass destruction. They were the ones that said that 135,000 Americans could easily conquer Iraq and not have any resistance. These are people. Had they been in, for instance, John F. Kennedy's administration, all would have been long gone. So you have Rumsfeld now blithely saying, oh, yeah, I mean, I guess there's nothing to connect Saddam and Al-Qaeda. I guess I was a little wrong on that. And here it is. Rumsfeld sees lack of proof for Qaeda-Hussein link. He says, to my knowledge, I have not seen any strong, hard evidence that links the two. Da, 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 da. In the meantime, 25,000 people dead later, sorry about that, from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, Baghdad in despair. Fear is ravaging Baghdad, bred by relentless violence, crime, and corruption, and every day it seeps more profoundly into day-to-day life. These are the people that are, you know, you get these people that are saying, oh, things are getting better. And when did I say, this is from the 5th, at least 26 die as three car bombs explode in Iraq. Well, I guess there was another 11 died today. And even worse here, Rumsfeld was talking to the Council on Foreign Relations the other day. And he said that he pointed the recent retaking of the former insurgent stronghold of Samarra in Iraq as evidence of the progress in stabilizing the country before elections in January. He said he doesn't think that there's going to be a civil war. But, said Donald Rumsfeld, who has been wrong about absolutely everything he's been wrong about. He says there's not going to be a civil war. He says, but what has to be done in that country is what basically was done in Samarra over the last 48 hours. The man who's been wrong about everything, he was the guy that said we could do this on the cheap and we could do invasion light, right? He says, what has to be done in that country, Iraq, is what basically was done in Samarra over the last 48 hours. Now, you don't see much of this in U.S. papers. Hold that quote in your mind. This is from the London Independence correspondent in Baghdad. Civilians bear brunt as Samarra, quote, pacified. Iraqi government and U.S. forces declared yesterday that they had pacified the rebel stronghold in Samarra and stated that other no-go enclaves, such as Fallujah, would be recaptured before national elections due in January. They're talking about 16 to 20 cities that Rumsfeld, the man wrong on everything, says the same thing is going to happen. Americans insisted that 125 people killed in the storming of the city were all insurgents. Doctors and local people reported women, children, and the elderly among the dead and that bodies were still being brought into hospitals. Local people in Samarra claimed that many of the 1,000 insurgents the Americans were targeting had escaped before the attack and civilians had borne the brunt of the casualties. Of the 70 bodies brought into Samarra General Hospital, 23 were children, 18 were women, said Abdul Nasser Hamid Yassin, a hospital administrator. There were also 23 women among the 160 wounded. Donald Rumsfeld says, what has to be done in that country is what basically was done in Samarra over the last 48 hours. So they're going to kill thousands and thousands of Iraqis. They're going to destroy more and more cities. It's what the Israelis do to the Palestinians. But there's a direct connection. This contest for land and what have you is awful as much of what the Israelis do in Palestine is in the kind of modern warfare. Our airplanes, purchased by our tax dollars. Well, here, what are the goals here? We're going to destroy 20 cities on the level that the United States destroyed Samarra with thousands and thousands of Iraqi casualties and hundreds more of American casualties, when you include the wounded, thousands more American casualties, because we're going to give them democracy. We're going to give them our way of life, even though there were no weapons of mass destruction and the country was invaded illegally. Bush lied. People died. That's the long and the short of it.
This is the RIS award-winning Night Call with Peter Werby. You can call in at 313-298-WRIF. Peter will return with more of your calls in just a moment.
Hi, ever see those people driving down the interstate with their turn signal on? mile after mile after mile. Think they've forgotten about it? No. It's a little memory device they're using to remind themselves of the healthy snack.
Cars nuts, cars nuts, cars nuts.
Cars nuts, low in carbs, high in protein, no cholesterol. We only use premium nuts, meticulously slow roasted and seasoned to perfection. Kind of makes you hungry, doesn't it? Go ahead, put your turn signal on. Oh, sure, you'll confuse a few drivers. Some will even gesture at you.
Hey, you moron!
But stay the course. Make the smart choice. Just head to the nearest service station or convenience store because nearly every one of them stocks Cars Nuts. And even though the next exit is 10 miles ahead, keep your turn signal on and remember,
Cars Nuts, Cars Nuts, Cars Nuts, Cars Nuts.
Make the right turn. Cars Nuts. That's Cars with a K. Okay? Since 1939.
Why are men all over America talking about Testosterpro? Listen.
After I tried Testosterpro, I felt like I was the man I wanted to be. I wish I'd found out about it sooner because I feel like I'm more of a man now than when I was younger.
I'm Dr. Richard Cohen, MD, men's health specialist. In many men, testosterone levels can fall rapidly after age 35. But now there's Testosterpro, the complete performance boosting system I designed for men who are starting to feel their age. If you don't feel like the man you used to be, call now for a 30-day risk-free trial of the Testosterpro system, which includes my bonus report on aging and its effects on energy, sex drive, and stamina, free with your order.
Call now for your confidential trial of Testosterpro. 1-800-897-3124. 1-800-897-3124. Results will vary. 1-800-897-3124. Guaranteed or your money back. 1-800-897-3124.
Attention Ford employees. In the event of a Ford plant closing, WRIF will be there with up-to-the-minute information. This message is brought to you by WRIF and the Ford Motor Company.
Stick around. More Night Call with Peter Werby. Coming up next.
The Motor City's best rock station, 101 WRIF, and the best radio website in the world, WRIF.com, brings the hottest deals in the Motor City. Now, WRIF.com makes your night on the town even better without hitting your wallet with Dine Online. You are now one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price.
Dine online and eat for less with WRIF.com.
Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's premier restaurants.
Like Mexican Town on Bagley in Detroit. You can purchase full-price gifts or certificates to area restaurants for only half price.
But quantities are limited, so hurry and order your half-price certificates now.
Dine online.
It's all from the station that delivers you more.
101 The Riff.
101 WRIF gives you the best deals in Detroit at WRIF.com. Check out special offers and savings from Motor City businesses.
Like Dr. Roche, put your best face and body forward with help from Dr. Roche.
Log on today and save
with the home of rock and roll at WRIF.com.
All right, listen up. I didn't get to be CEO of such a magnificent airline by thinking small. No, sir. I'm going to take on those trendy low-cost airlines like Spirit by thinking big, really big, which is the very reason you experts are here. So tell me, what was your last big expansion project?
I just did the extra bedroom on Mrs. Jameson's house.
And I did a double garage.
Perfect. I knew I picked the right people.
Why fly an airline that's trying to be like Spirit when you can fly the real thing? At Spirit, we're expanding to bring you more flights and new destinations all the time, like nonstop service from Detroit to Providence, serving the Boston area starting October 28th, and starting November 18th, another new Spirit Caribbean destination, Santo Domingo, connecting in Fort Lauderdale. Book online now at spiritair.com for some of the lowest fares to these cities, as well as L.A. and Las Vegas, and seasonal service to West Palm Beach.
Sir, if you don't mind me saying so, we don't have a business plan here.
Oh, yes, we do. I bought one of those last week.
Spirit Airlines.
This is Night Call. The Riff's phone-in talk show. Now, here's Peter Werby.
Oh, when the draft comes marching in, oh, when the draft comes marching in, I hope they don't call your boy's number when the draft comes marching in. Oh, when our boys go overseas, demand for troops starts to increase. We wonder why Mr. Bush ever went there. When the draft comes marching in, we bombed Iraq without our lives, a place with no Al-Qaeda ties. And as the chaos grows ever larger, we'll watch the draft come marching in. Oh, when the draft come marching in.
Could come back, folks. Could come back. That's from the album Political Spin, Ralph Paterno, P-A-T-E-R-N-O. You go to politicalsongs.net. Got a lot of great songs on this album. Political Spin, Ralph Paterno, P-A-T-E-R-N-O, politicalsongs.net. You know, I've just been inundated with emails. I'm having a little trouble with this over the last few weeks. Our producer, Dan Lutarsky, has been getting them for me, but we have a little problem. Still haven't made the big move to our new studios, but I've just been inundated with emails at calltalkyes at yahoo.com that says, remember that guy called up and it makes him sick when people say they're going to vote for Kerry because... one of the things he had this quote about essentially that Kerry advocated a unilateral and preemptive attack on Iraq. Turns out absolutely fraudulent. Manufactured by the right-wing Mooney paper, the Washington Times, and Drudge, the Drudge Report. Far right-wing guy. Here's a gay guy. Drudge, Matt Drudge, who's backing the most homophobic administration in since the 1920s or something like that. Anyway, so you got to look into this stuff. And that's why I count on you. Yeah, you know, remember I've said this before. When you listen to these right-wing broadcasts, which dominate the airwaves, the callers bring almost, and people that email, bring almost nothing. Nothing to the broadcast. They're just foils for the font. You know, the right wing, ditto Rush, megadiddos, and they'll bring up a little thing about, oh, they've found some new foible of a liberal. But, see, I didn't know this, and I count on you. That's why every once in a while I say something that's wrong, and everybody just hops on. Good, correct me. They find something wrong on the website, peterwerby.com, got to change it in a second. Remember they asked Bush, can you name three mistakes you ever made? And he just started defending Iraq. Here's a man incapable, absolutely incapable of admitting he made mistakes. And I'm reaching here for what I can't find. Oh, yeah. This is a little tough because the person asks me not to use their name or profession or town, but they said that... they were talking about Kerry. It was a swell idea to go in there well hydrated. She says, I appreciated that you hardly, just talking to Kerry, you hardly took a sip of water while your competition was constantly going for a drink. And when his father was talked about, he double gulped. The more stress he feels, the more he gulps. This is a leftover from his days of drinking, Bush's days of drinking, when a swallow of alcohol would decrease his stress level. She says, I feel sorry for him that he has all the symptoms, what they call dry drunk syndrome. All right, let's get back to our phone. 313-298-WRIF. Hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Peter. How you doing?
Doing good. Who's this?
This is James from Kenosha, Wisconsin.
Oh, James. Hey, I guess we're streaming tonight.
We are streaming, although I had a hard time because I couldn't figure out which of the internets to tune in on. If you remember that from the debate, Bush referred to the internets.
Oh, yeah, the internets. There's more than
there's
one.
Many of them.
Yeah.
And fortunately, you're on all of them. So,
good.
You, in terms of Kerry and the war, I heard or read a comment recently that compared this is the choice we have in this election to Nixon stepping in after LBJ in Vietnam. And that's frightening. But based on the rhetoric of the Democrats, it is... It looks like we're heading that way, and the draft that song referred to could be coming under either party.
Well, right? I have one of these fence-sitting friends of mine that just says that I'm unnecessarily riling people up. There's no way in the world that the American public would sit still for this. Now, the Republicans, of course, are, as they did in most wars, they let the poor and the working class fight the battles where they cheer them on for this from the sidelines with their flags and, you know, their solemnity about sacrifice and nothing they're ever willing to put forth. But if they, suddenly there was a draft, probably these Republican kids would be in the forefront of an anti-draft movement. I don't know that it'd be politically possible to institute a draft by either party.
I think you're correct, and I also believe the military, when they make the claim that they don't want a draft because it makes for an overall more difficult situation for training and troop morale and such. So,
but they are over; they don't have enough people.
No, I know, and that's eventually. You know, there was a great report in 60 Minutes tonight about the Sudan and the Darfur region and the genocide. And from that debate, and both of the candidates, we can't commit troops. We don't have the troops to commit to that situation. And it's tragic because we're looking at perhaps upwards of a million people that may die as a result of this.
Doesn't matter. No oil there.
Yeah, there's no oil. And even if we had true humanitarian hearts, we don't have the troops to do anything. If I can, real quick, despite all the great work being done to register new voters, I hate to bring up anything that smacks of a poll tax, but I just finished reading Seymour Hersh's new book, Chain of Command.
Mm-hmm.
And I think every voter should be required to read this before they get going to the poll, because if you have any doubt that intelligence was cooked beyond the boiling point, or any doubt that it's not just Bush, but it's a sick administration that's leading to the corruption of the entire military complex, if that's possible. I mean, it's like you were saying before. I mean, Rumsfeld has gotten everything wrong, but he's still in his job. Cheney has taken and politicized the intelligence apparatus of the CIA in a way that it was never meant to be. The entire thing is corrupt.
Yeah, actually, you know, I mentioned John F. Kennedy before. Kennedy fired these advisors who told him to invade Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
He got wrong information from them. He got bad information. Why don't any heads ever roll in the Bush gang?
The only thing we've seen is a tenant stepping out, supposedly of his own volition, and low-level troops being court-martialed over there.
Yeah.
But the big guy, Condoleezza Rice, who ultimately takes the fall as the president, the liaison to the president in terms of security issues, she's still floating around, completely incapable of doing her job.
Well, I think we're going to send them all home.
I hope you're right.
All right. Thank you, James. Thanks for calling in from Kenosha, Wisconsin. Hi, it's WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hi, Peter Werby.
Hi.
Hi, this is Ron Reeder from Stevenson in southwestern Ontario.
Welcome.
Well, glad to talk to you. First off, John Cabot, I think he came across and found North America.
So did the Vikings, like in...
No, there was an ice bridge before that, and that's where that Indian...
Well, then there was Atlantis. You could just, just a little hop, skip, and a jump, but go ahead. Just kidding.
Hey, I was just watching the debate the other day,
mm-hmm.
and the way I see it is that we've got to protect our borders as one North America. And John Kerry seems to have a plan for that. He's not really telling us what it is, but, I mean, it beats the heck out of Bush. I mean, dealing with Iraq, you know, we still got Canadian troops in Afghanistan.
Really? I didn't know that they were still there. I thought they got kind of burnt there. When the United States planes bombed the Canadian troops?
What? That was a long time ago. No, there's still Canadian troops.
Oh, yeah, it was about 2 years ago, or a year and a half ago.
So there's no troops in Afghanistan?
No, when the United States troops accidentally bombed the Canadians.
Was that? No, I'm just saying that the war is out of control.
It is out of control. All right, thanks for making our show international. I appreciate you calling 313-298-WRIF. You know, the Vote for Change tour with Bruce Springsteen, Dave Matthews Band, Bonnie Raitt, Dixie Chicks, Jackson Browne, James Taylor, Keb Moe, Kenny Babyface Edmonds, Pearl Jam, REM. I've been going around the country saying, got to be some change here. Get registered to vote. A lot of young people are are for the first time voting in mass. And it was kind of hard to get tickets to a lot of these shows, particularly the Bruce Springsteen shows. Well, tomorrow night, the Sundance Channel is going to broadcast a television special called National Anthem, Inside the Vote for Change Concert Tour. It's a documentary made by these incredible documentary makers, including D.A. Pennebaker, who's made documentaries about the Rolling Stones and Dylan and the Beatles. And it's going to, let me see, the National Anthem will air on October 11th from 6:30 p.m. to 11:30 p.m. Eastern Time. I don't get this too much. But anyways, you can actually see this on the Internet, though, if you don't have the Sundance Channel, which I do not. You can either go to my website, peterwerbe.com, W-E-R-B-E.com, or just go to moveon.org. And what MoveOn is doing, and these are very, very important. They're kind of called meetups or house parties where people get together, and they've done it around a number of different issues. And one of the things that Bushco depends upon is it will be these isolated fragments rather than a community or a culture or a society, and we'll just be sitting and watching Foxhole News and just soaking up every lie. Well, suddenly when people get together, a whole different dynamic takes place. So they're going to have these house parties tomorrow night, and you can go to moveon.org, and you can see where they are in your area. You just put in your zip code, and it'll show you somebody's house. You go over there and watch it. Hear Bruce Springsteen, R.E.M., and Pearl Jam. And you also get to hang with people. Which is a lot more satisfying than watching this stuff on television. I mean, I know that's kind of television, too, but it's a different kind of thing. I mean, it's got a very specific point to it. And along those lines, Roy, who listens in Placidas, New Mexico, he said, a few friends and I have reserved the Placidas Community Center. They're going to have a free screening of, and then he lists all these films. Some of them they've already shown. Orwell Rolls in His Grave, Fahrenheit 9/11, the day it comes out on video, which is October 5th. How long? Oh, I've had this since September 12th? Sorry, Roy. Bush's Brain, which is out as well. And Greg Palast's Bush Family Fortunes, very, very important. Shows all the connections with the Saudis. You can go to Greg Palast, PALAST.com. And he says, discussion follows, trying to get some candidates show up. And he says, as important, folks will meet other folks. We print off some flyers, run a $30 ad in the community paper, call a couple of talk shows, etc. We can entertain and educate. And here's the deal, too. You don't even have to go that far. I mean, just get your neighbors together. A lot of people say, I wouldn't pay Michael Moore a dime. All right, well, say, hey, I got the DVD now. I got the DVD. A lot of you bought it, I know. Come on over and watch it. Or, you know, you can make a deal with these conservatives. Let's have dueling videos. You watch Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11, and I'll watch whatever you've got, all right? And then we'll talk about it. Which makes more sense? All right, let's take another call before our break, another couple maybe. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Good evening. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Thanks.
I'm not very heavily into politics, but over the years I've been paying attention to some of the interviews and stuff like that, and I caught parts of the debates.
You know, we got a terrible connection. Can you hear that?
I can hear you. Yes.
No, but can you also hear that?
No.
Are you on a cell phone?
Yes.
Can you walk a little or drive a little somewhere else?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead. Let's try it. You know, I'm going to put you on hold and have you talk to our producer, and then we'll see what we can do. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Good evening. How are you?
Doing good, thanks.
You know, they want to talk about Bush flip-flopping. I've been reading a book called House of Bush, House of Saud.
Amazing. I interviewed Craig Unger, right?
Yeah, I heard the interview. Went out and bought the book.
Oh, good.
Paperback.
Good. So
they have a quote here from when he was campaigning.
What's that?
Our nation stands alone right now in the world in terms of power. That's why we've got to be humble and yet project strength in a way that promotes freedom. If we're an arrogant nation, they'll view us that way. But if we're a humble nation, they'll respect us.
Hmm.
He seems to have flip-flopped completely there. You're either with us or against us.
Well, did you hear what he said about stem cells? He said when you kill a stem cell, you kill a human life. And then he said, I'm the first president to have funded stem cell research. Now, wait a minute. You just said it was murder. You're pandering to your right-wing base. And then the next sentence, he says he funds it. So he's funding murder? I mean, the guy, there hasn't been anybody in the history of the Republic more inadequate to sit in the White House. That's why he lost the presidency in 2000 and had to be projected there by...
Well, he won the election 5-4.
Yeah, that's right. He did. Yeah, yeah.
The other point they bring up in that book that I find really telling, and it's a real major flip-flop, is... And the guy Craig Unger says right off the bat, you know, his courting of the extreme Muslim vote, the extremists that won him Florida.
Yeah, yeah.
But
and
then, boom, you know, he gets in office and he sounds like, you know, hey, I'm a card-carrying member of the Likud party and backs Israel in every God-blessed misplay they've made where they've killed... They killed 300 Palestinians a year. They wound 11,000 Palestinians a year, but, you know, 20 Israelis die, and it's terrorism.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, all right. Thank you for your call, and we're going to take a little break here and break back to get more of your calls.
Your opinion matters. Call 313-298-WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call and more of your calls coming up.
I am Erebus, the four-story haunted attraction in downtown Pontiac that you've heard about. This Friday and Saturday, when you and your puny little friends arrive at my four-story haunted attraction in downtown Pontiac, it won't be pretty. Last year, you didn't believe me. Last year, we bit you, we grabbed you, and impaled you with anxiety. This weekend, not only will I show no mercy, but I, Erebus, will personally bury you alive. And when you fall on your knees, cry, and start to babble, only one thing will come out of your mouth. Mama! Mama! You whiny little puke! You didn't understand! I told you! I am Erebus, the best four-story haunted attraction in the nation, and I show no mercy!
Erebus, the four-story haunted attraction, will be waiting for you this weekend, located in downtown Pontiac across the street from the Phoenix Center.
Hi, I'm David Hall with an example of a late-night email from rockfinancial.com. Mike from West Bloomfield heard about the SmartArm 3 years ago, and here's what happened to him. He was buying a car and needed $20,000, so he decided to refinance instead of getting a new loan. So when Mike refinanced with the SmartArm to take out the cash to get the new car, his payment actually went down by $300 a month. So he added the money he was going to purchase the car for to his loan, and his payment went down by $300 a month. The interest rate on the SmartArm really drove his payment down. So 3 years later, all the principal is paid off, and the payment is still lower than it was 3 years ago, and he paid off the car. What a great story from rockfinancial.com. We get emails every day and every night, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You can get help at rockfinancial.com. Go right now. rockfinancial.com.
Rock Financial is a Quicken Loans company, an equal housing lender. 24/7 you'll have access to mortgage calculators, great information, and more at rockfinancial.com.
More Night Call with Peter Worthy next on The Riff.
This is another Riff Rock concert.
The unmistakable, the great vintage fury. November 14th, live on stage at the State Theater. Marilyn Manson.
Reach out and touch fate, fate.
Intimate and in your face.
Lots of everyone in the dope show.
married. I felt immediately comfortable and at home. Every single person cares about what you come in there for.
That's Jared.
Jared, the Galleria of Jewelry customer, Ryan Moorman.
I went in, I was overlooking at some watches. The watch specialist, very knowledgeable, telling me stories about all the different watchmakers and just sharing his personal knowledge and obviously his passion for watches.
Jared has five times the selection of ordinary jewelry stores.
They have a customer for life.
Jared is the place to shop for gifts if you're looking for a more extensive selection of fine Swiss timepieces. Come in today to see the Omega Men's Seamaster line, the Movado Museum Collection, the elegant design from Raymond Weil, the amazing Tissot T touchscreen watch, or the Tag Heuer Tiger Woods chronograph. All at Jared, the Galleria of Jewelry.
It can only be Jared.
Jared, on Baldwin Road in Auburn Hills, across from 12 Oaks in Novi, in Utica at M59 in the Van Dyke Expressway, and our newest store across from Oakland Mall in Troy.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Now, more of your comments, questions, and opinions with your host, Peter Werby.
Sort of like 7-Eleven. We're not always doing business, but we're always home.
And I'm sure now, with Homeland Security in place, that we all feel just a bit better tonight, don't we?
I'm watching Michael Moore expose the awful truth. I'm listening to Public Enemy and Reagan Youth. I see no world peace cause the zealous armed forces. I eat no breakfast cause I'm from the hub horses. Now I can't believe what an absolute failure. The president's laughing cause he voted for NATO.
Yeah, that's NOFX on Night Call. 313-298-WRIF. Let's go directly back to our phones. Hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Good evening.
Good evening. I had a couple questions I wanted to ask you. You stated earlier that you didn't think that John Kerry would do any better than Bush, but at the same time you stated that you don't think he could possibly do any worse.
No, I just said I don't think anybody could do any worse than George W. Bush has in terms of making wrong moves, wrong commitments, and endangering us. It's impossible. Almost. Well, I suppose there's some you could do, but not within the within reasonable context.
Well, all right, now, what about Bill Clinton? What do you think about, did you think he was a great president?
A great president. I don't know. He managed to, we weren't, let me say this. It wasn't a crisis a day that we didn't find ourselves in these manufactured crises day after day after day. But, I mean, I never voted for Bill Clinton. This is the first time in my voting life that I'm going to vote for a Democratic candidate for president. That's how awful I think that George W. Bush is.
What do you think the worst thing that it was that he's done? I mean, there's been a lot of things that he's done that's been just as good for our country as bad. I mean,
name two.
Just because he went to war, I mean, everybody's getting on his back, but
Wait a minute. There's a couple of things that are going on here. There was a criminal assault on the United States of the most horrific nature on September 11, 2001. The people responsible for it had a hideout in Afghanistan. And there's two things that went wrong, because Bush had long-term plans to establish either indirect or, in this case, direct control over South Asia pipeline territory, and also a longer-range scheme to control oil in the Middle East. Rather than concentrating on capturing Osama bin Laden and bringing to justice the people responsible for inflicting the damage, they did two things. They spent their time fighting the Taliban government, which were still embroiled in this unsettled affair over there, and then began immediately to turn their attention to play the Iraq card for the benefit of the elections of 2002, which took men and materiel away from the possibility of ever catching Osama bin Laden. That was a catastrophic mistake. You also have to remember there was only one man who was president on September 11, 2001, that if you read any of the books of people that talk about intelligence failures, maybe Clinton was just as bad. But you know what? It didn't happen when Bill Clinton was president. And if Bill Clinton would have been president, or if Al Gore would have been president, the Republicans would have been calling for his impeachment for the worst misfeasance in office in the history of our country.
All right. Well, what about... Okay, so you think that since Bush was in office when the September 11th attacks happened, that Bush is responsible. You think that he didn't do anything to protect us?
Well, he went on vacation after he got this notice saying that that Al-Qaeda was on the verge of making a strike within the United States. His director of security, for some reason or other, right out of my brain right now, had been imploring the Bush administration to pay some attention to this. Ashcroft didn't even have terrorism on the top 10 points of importance on his budget. I mean, these guys are colossal failures. Whatever they do, if their businesses go belly up, I mean, they never, you know, they're these rich guys, so they never have to pay the consequences. I mean, Bush traded Sammy Sosa.
Well, what do you, I don't understand what that has anything to do with it. How many terrorist attacks have we received and nothing's happened? That's what I'm saying.
Oh, you mean he's been successful in that nothing's happened, right? Well, I don't know. Maybe, hopefully, what they're doing is, with all the services, hopefully they are involved in police work, not wars. There is no war on terrorism. It's an impossibility. You want to find the culprits before they are able to accomplish anything, and you want to have security enough so that people can't bring that kind of thing about. Something that should have been done before September 11th. So it's a little bit of closing the barn door after the horse is gone. So if the police forces and the intelligence services and the armed forces are stopping terrorist attacks from happening in this country, that's well and good. That's what should happen. I don't think John Kerry is going to do any worse at that. But there are so many other things that are going on. You sound like you're probably under 25. You and your children and your grandchildren are going to be paying off the debt that out of your tax money that George Bush has run up. We're looking at second-rate schools. We're looking at a decaying infrastructure. Let me just read you. There's something you might want to check this out. It's punkvoter.com. Here's Bush's accomplishments. First president in U.S. history to enter office with a criminal record. In his first 2 years in office, over 2 million Americans lost their job. Members of the Bush cabinet are the richest administration in history, the poorest multimillionaire is Condoleezza Rice, who has a Chevron tanker named after her. Spent the surplus and bankrupted the Treasury. Shattered record for biggest annual deficit in history. Set economic record for the most private bankruptcies filed in any 12-month period. Set all-time record for biggest drop in the history of the stock market. First year in office, set the all-time record for most days on vacation by any president in U.S. history. After taking the entire month of August off for vacation, presided over the worst security failure in U.S. history. Cut unemployment benefits for more out-of-work Americans than any president in U.S. history. Set the all-time record for most foreclosures in a 12-month period. Appointed more convicted criminals to administration positions than any president in U.S. history. Signed more laws and executive orders amending the Constitution than any president in U.S. history. I don't know what that's about. Cut health care benefits for war veterans. Dissolved more international treaties than any president in U.S. history. And I could spend the rest of the evening writing. Do you think these are lies, or do you think this is okay that these happened?
No, I'm not saying that it's okay that these happened. I'm just saying that there's a lot of people that are always focusing on what Bush didn't do instead of what he did. And then when he does something, there's little bitches like you that try and screw him over and
talk shit about it. Why do you talk? What do you mean? What is this little bitches thing?
I think you're a little bitch. What's wrong with that?
Well, I mean,
you should be taken off the
What were you saying?
Bitch.
What?
You should be.
Well, look it. If you were here, I'd probably just put you over my lap and spank you for being a bad little boy. Now, take an anger management course and, try to deal with your problems some other way. You're not doing a good job of it. Typical Bush supporter, okay? Okay, since he, this is from punkvoter.com. We did that. Presided over the biggest corporate stock market fraud of any market in any country in the history of the world. Set the all-time record for the biggest annual budget spending increases more than any president in U.S. history. Withdrew from the World Court of Law. Now, you know, they once in a while they use that old phrase for Kerry, tax and spend liberal. Bush's tax cut and spend. I mean, maybe you don't like tax and spend, because I mean, there's nothing wrong with taxes if we're getting something back. But let me see, gee, where did that all go? Here's where Bush has our money going. What a jerk that guy was. Huh? In 2001, two researchers and a Columbia University fertility expert published a startling finding in a respected medical journal. Women undergoing fertility treatment who had been prayed for by Christian groups were twice as likely to have a successful pregnancy as those who did not. This was a study that's being founded by our government. Let's see, critics that the federal government has contributed $2.3 million in financing over the last 4 years for prayer research. Now, there's something about a positive state. When people say every once in a while, you know, I say I'm an atheist, and they say, I'll pray for you. I say, good, do it. Yeah, maybe I'm wrong. So good, pray for me. That particularly if you pray yourself, if you don't just give up, you know, you're going to pray to God, you know, please spare me or whatever one does, beseech the Lord to heal you. Okay, you know, then maybe that does work. But other people praying for you, I mean, there's a premise there that is absolutely inconsistent with a secular society like ours and absolutely violates the First Amendment that talks about no establishment of religion, and taking my money and your money and financing a prayer study. These people, we are being run and ruled by a pack of religious psychos, folks, which is perfectly all right. Here's the difference. Here is the difference. I don't want to force anything on them. I don't want to force gays on them. I don't want to force rock and roll. I don't want to force dope. I don't want to force, what else don't they, you know, all this stuff. I don't want to force any of them that on them. I don't want to force abortion on them. Yeah, whatever they want, they can do within, you know, legal limits. But they are always, and this is a true mark of an authoritarian personality. This is why these people are proto-fascists. They want to put their nasty little agenda on us. This is a culture war. This is going to be determined, what's going to be determined on November 2nd? Are we going to be ruled by an ignoramus that does not believe in evolution? To think, man. All right. So they got this Columbia University fertility expert who says that women undergoing fertility treatment who had been prayed for by Christian groups were twice as likely to have a successful pregnancy as those who had not. 3 years later, after one of the researchers pleaded guilty to conspiracy and an unrelated business fraud, Columbia is investigating the study, and the journal reportedly pulled the paper from its website. That's the other thing. They're the biggest hypocrites in the world. They always have this nice smiling demeanor, and we want you all to, you know, to have the blessings of the Lord and all this, and they're so sanctimonious and self-righteous, and they're corrupt through and through. They're liars, they're cheats, they're on the take, they always have the fix in. Dr. Richard J. McNally, a psychologist at Harvard, says intercessory, that means intervening. Intercessory prayer presumes some supernatural intervention that is by definition beyond the reach of science. He said it is just a non-starter, in my opinion, a total waste of time and money. So is that okay, Republicans? Send off $2.3 million to prove that prayer helps pregnancy. Maybe somebody told them that you got to do it. You know, I don't know, some of these people, you know, there is this little act. They don't like that, right? They don't really like that. Here's somewhere else where our money is going. The State Department has awarded an explicitly anti-feminist U.S. group part of a $10 million grant to train Iraqi women in political participation and democracy. Again, these are these far-right wing nut cases that are in this Washington-based Independent Women's Forum. They're going to help implement the administration's Iraqi Women's Democracy Initiative. And they have some other groups in them that aren't so bad. But they also, the recipients of the grant also include the Bangalore-based, where is it? That's some other country-based Art of Living Foundation, a volunteer organization that promotes yoga and other breathing exercises to eliminate stress, create a sense of belonging, and restore human values. Which I think is cool. I mean, I think yoga is wonderful. Breathing and meditation is excellent. But I don't want to pay $10 million for this. We need some schools opened here in the Detroit area. We need books for our kids. We need the roads fixed. We have a state that's going into debt even with all the cuts. We need to cut tuition prices for our colleges. In fact, we need to have free tuition instead of sending $200 billion to, you know, the Carlyle Group in Halliburton. Now, the participation in the IWF, this is the far right-wing group, which has escorted Iraqi women selected by the State Department around power and media centers around Washington, is the most controversial. So this is, you know, what they're doing. The organization was founded in 1991 by a number of prominent right-wing Republican women to act as a counterpoint to what they called the radical feminism of the National Organization for Women. Among the founders, Lynn Cheney, the spouse of Vice President Dick Cheney, Labor Secretary Elaine Chao, Cato Byrne, Washington editor of the right-wing National Review, and former senior vice president of the Heritage Foundation, and Midge Dechter, the former co-chair with Donald Rumsfeld, the Committee for the Free World. So, I mean, this is racket, folks, except we're paying the money. They're not even extorting it from us. We're just, you know, like that. Let's see, the IWF, the Independent Women's Forum, these far-right-wing women, has also opposed federal programs designed to prevent sexual discrimination in educational institutions that receive federal government funding. So, I mean, this is totally nuts. This is who they're going to have help women. The Bush administration appointed IWF's president, Nancy Mitchell-Fotenhauer, to the National Advisory Committee on Violence Against Women, despite the fact that the group opposed the Violence Against Women Act. This is always it. They take a lobbyist from the miners that want to expand the amount of coal dust that's allowed in the air in mines, and they make him... Now, he couldn't get in the door in the Clinton and Gore administration. Now, he's head of mine safety, and now miners are sucking more coal dust. So we'll have more people to pay for when they get black lung. We will do that. We'll be paying for that. Let's see, what else? Bush refused to allow inspectors access to U.S. prisoners of war and by default no longer abide by the Geneva Conventions. First president in U.S. history to refuse United Nations election inspectors during the 2002 U.S. elections. All-time U.S. and world record holder for the most corporate campaign donations. First president in U.S. history to unilaterally attack a sovereign nation against the will of the United Nations and the world community. First president to run and hide when the U.S. came under attack and then lied, saying the enemy had the code to Air Force One. Remember that? That's leadership? I mean, how can a Republican listen to this? What do they say? It's either all this is lies. Punkvoter.com made it all up. This isn't true. None of it. It's all lies. A pack of lies. Or they have to say, well, that's okay. I don't care that he did that, you know, because it's this culture war. They want this fascistic, corporatist regime to continue. No matter how many Iraqis are killed, no matter how many Americans are killed, no matter how bad the economy gets, no matter how bad our schools and roads and everything else get. Took the biggest world, so that's kind of a matter of opinion. First U.S. president to establish a secret shadow government. You didn't even know about that, did you? Change U.S. policy to allow convicted criminals to be awarded government contracts. Set all-time record for number of administration appointees who have violated U.S. law by not selling huge investments in corporations bidding for government contracts. Failed to fulfill pledge. What, is that me saying that right? Failed to fulfill pledge to get Osama bin Laden dead or alive. Hey, he's got about 3 weeks. He might pull him out. Failure to capture the anthrax killer. 18 months following 9/11 attacks, he has successfully prevented any public investigation into the big... Well, he finally went along with that. And on and on and on. Past work experience. Ran for Congress and lost. Produced a Hollywood slasher B-movie. Bought an oil company but couldn't find oil in Texas. Company went bankrupt shortly after Bush sold all his stock. Bought the Texas Rangers baseball team in a sweetheart deal that took land using taxpayer money. Biggest move, traded Sammy Sosa to Chicago. With father's help and his name was elected governor of Texas. On and on and on. On. This man has got to go for no other reason so we can talk about something else. November 3rd, well, it'll be the Sunday after that. We'll be playing from From Wizard of Oz. Ding dong, the wicked witch is dead. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, Peter, how you doing?
Good. Want me to tell you what I really think?
Yeah, but after I get done here.
Okay. Go ahead.
Listen, I wanted to say, you know, a couple things. You mentioned all the hypocrisy of the right wing. It's just unbelievable. But one of the great examples to me is Rush Limbaugh right now fighting his drug case. You know, he's fighting being indicted for several felonies involving the purchase of these illegal prescription drugs that he was buying in the Denny's parking lot down there. But what he's fighting it on is based on his, quote, right to privacy.
Right.
But, you know, for years, Limbaugh has championed Robert Bork. And one of the reasons why is because Robert Bork is on record as saying there is no right to privacy in the Constitution. This is just something everybody made up. But now Russia's got a liberal lawyer, the Kennedy lawyer, Roy Black, out there fighting based on Russia's, quote, right to privacy.
They are just the biggest hypocrites. Yeah, and the Supreme Court, of Florida, just held that his rights of privacy were not violated. So what might happen to Rush might be what he's always advocated for drug law violators. Lock him up!
Well, you cannot use the right to privacy to cover up a felony. But anyway, but the next thing I want to talk about is, you know, Karl Rove and the rest I've been reading, they're a little nervous that they haven't been able to put more distance between them and Kerry in this campaign. And over the next month, they plan to go extremely negative on Kerry. They plan to do what Bush's father did to Dukakis. You know, every other word out of Bush's mouth for the next month will be liberal, Massachusetts, liberal.
I was just walking the other day. I mean, I walked through all these suburbs. One of them is this kind of upscale Pleasant Ridge community where I don't live. And it's really funny. Of all the communities I walk through, which are Oak Park, Pleasant Ridge, Ferndale, and Royal Oak, the most upscale is Pleasant Ridge. And their signs, Kerry signs, outnumber Bush signs like 20 to 1. I mean, it's odd to see a Bush sign there. Anyways, I ran into a political operative who's worked on presidential campaigns before, and he said that Bush's speech was the most vicious he had ever heard. First, he said it was the most vicious he had ever heard from a sitting president. And then he said, actually, it's the most vicious speech, just one of his attacks on Kerry, one of the most vicious speeches that he's heard from any presidential candidate in 30 years. And I don't think the American people are buying it. They have this image of Bush of this real nice guy, and he's not very nice at all. He's a mean son of a bitch.
Well, he's becoming a pit bull anymore, and he's also... But they're going to drag out these swift vote veterans more and more in the next few weeks.
No,
and,
you think so? Don't you think they've used up their little deal? They've had their 15 minutes of fame?
Well, they've got a lot of money to spend yet. But also what I wanted to say about this thing is that, you know how FDR said there's nothing to fear but fear itself? And
yeah.
Kennedy said, ask not what your country can do for you. And Reagan, it was a shining city on the hill. Bush's theme, he will be always remembered for, is... Need some wood?
Need some wood? Yeah. It turned out, by the way, that Bush does own that lumber company.
I couldn't believe that. This man, Peter, I hate this man, is a moron.
Well, you know what? We say he's a moron. He's a moron for the job. There is so much, an intellectual level needed for that position, and he's probably a guy of average intelligence that's extraordinarily lazy and absolutely not inquisitive at all. Let me say this: I don't think I probably, if we took an IQ test, probably Bush and I could wind up to be like the same basic IQ. Except, I work like hell. I got so many friends of mine that teach college and, you know, are university professors. I mean, sometimes when I hear them talking, I go, man, I can hardly grasp what they're talking about. These guys are like the brains, the geniuses of our generation. I'm nothing like that. So what I got to do is I got to work real hard, and I got to read a lot, and I have to be inquisitive, and I have to read things over, and I have to compare things. And I, you know, some of these guys seem to have like photographic memory. I can't remember anything. I got to write everything down, and I go back and read stuff, and I have files. It drives me nuts half the time. But no way in the world would I ever want to be a president. I mean, Kerry has the capacity, whatever we think of his policies. Clinton and Gore had the capacity. Bush is so far out of his league, I don't know how he is dealing with it emotionally.
Well, Bush brags that he doesn't read the paper. And also, you know, I always said, and I lived in Texas when he was becoming governor, and but one writer wrote, if this man's name was George W. Smith instead of Bush, he'd probably be selling appliances at Sears.
Sure. Absolutely. An honorable profession, but not someone that belongs as the resident. I'll never call him the president unless I'm quoting something of the United States. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. I'm forgetting about all these emails. My apologies. I definitely will read them. Short ones are best. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. From Daryl in Sterling Heights, he says, the idiot caller. What was he called? You little bitch, he called me. Hey, Peter, how can anyone that still has the mental capacity to breathe and feed themselves still support Butchko? They all do the same as that caller that attacked you. Confront them with some simple facts, and they fall to the fallacy of personal attacks. Why are people still supporting this riot-worthy regime? I think it's the disinformation and thought manufacturing in the media. But what's your take? I mean, I really do think they're fascists. They love power. They it's partly the Stockholm syndrome. Let me get an idea. Dan Letarski, you know what the Stockholm syndrome is? Okay, that happened probably before you were born. In Stockholm, these I don't know why they did. I think maybe bank robbers. They took these people hostage, and there was this standoff for days and days and days and days, and the hostages began identifying with the hostage takers, the bank robbers, and psychologists said it's because of the overwhelming power and the capacity to completely control the lives of the people being held captive. So that's what a lot of these Bush supporters are. Some of them are religious nuts, gun nuts, you know, the different kinds of psychos, haters. They see the Democratic Party of people they really despise, women, gays, minorities, working people, what have you. And so a lot of it is just the party of resentment, a real deep founded hatred. And they also, there's this cultural resentment. They don't like the rock and roll culture, you know, stuff like that. Sexuality of any kind really scares and bothers them, let alone something that's a little off the map for them. We should have compassion for them. Some level I do. But get out of our lives. Settle your problems out of government. Don't try to force your views on us. If you don't want to have abortions, and I'm not putting that off on that same category. If you don't have abortions, don't have them. No, don't try to force it, your view of theology and biology on the rest of us. If you don't like gay relationships, don't have them. You know? But don't try to force your religious views on other people who have loving, important relationships in our community. All right, where are we at? Line 2, is that it? Thank you. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. It's Peter Werby. Go ahead.
Peter Werby, how you doing? My name's Tim. I'm a second-time caller. I spoke to you months ago over my cousin being in Iraq, and I listen to you as frequent as I can. I work in a kitchen, so my schedule changes all the time. Within these last couple months of this whole voting thing and the whole presidential election, I really started paying attention to things, and in the last few years, with all the things that have happened, I really thought I had to, you know, I need to actually get into it. I didn't vote when I was 18, and I missed it, so I'm voting this year for sure. And I saw Fahrenheit 9/11 for the mm-hmm. first time. I watched it 3 times in a row. It blew me away.
Wow.
You know, and it saddens me to see how this could happen to our country. At the same time, they shoot back. You've seen the movie, of course.
Sure.
And they show they do flashbacks to his dad, and they show things. You know, and I believe it was like 1992. Bush stated that, you know, my last name's George. My last name's Bush. I can do whatever I want. I can get a hold of my dad at any time.
Right.
Basically, like saying I'm the spoiled little brat. I want what my dad has. You know, and it just, I think that this year, as far as young voters, 18 to 30, I'm 22 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's going to be a really big number. I don't know if they're going to categorize that or statistically put that out there, but
yeah,
I
they can. They are.
Okay.
Let me tell you one thing about voting. I don't know if you heard me earlier. I said that my wife and I just sent in absentee ballots. I think the lines are going to be around the block triple. And I think that there's probably going to be the biggest turnout in, I don't know, maybe 30 or 40 years. I think it's going to might even be over 60%, which will mean for sure, if it's anything over 54%, Bush loses. That's why the Republicans are trying to suppress the vote.
Exactly. I mean, I watch MTV a lot, you know, whatever. They're pushing this vote thing a lot more than they did the first time around, you know, and it's going to be, we're going to make the decision because my generation is the generation that's going to have to clean up his mess, and so it's up to us to make the change.
You're right.
My cousin is finally home from Iraq now.
Great.
And we just recently went and visited him, and the stuff he had to tell me, it blew my mind. It's just how can such a person have, you know, just think that way? And another thing, I don't want to get too far off, but I just want to give my opinion on the whole Bush administration, if you will. I believe that the reason why, I mean, this whole thing happened, September 11th or whatnot, and the reason, you know, George Bush Sr. still talks with the Saudis and whatnot is because it's kind of like when you're fighting with friends and you're playing both sides of the fence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't want them to know who the real enemy is, and even though I think it happened to us because we were doing it to them. You know, it kind of like it was just our turn, and they did that because they, you know, they Saudi Arabia, the Iraqi embassy, what, owned 6% of the country?
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know much, like you said, you know, you got friends that are extremely intelligent, and it's hard to grasp what they say, but when I listen to you, you know, it makes you say the things that I want to say, but you say them so much better. So I just want, you know, I really respect you. I respect your show. Try to listen to it every Sunday religiously if I can when I'm up. And I check your website all the time, man. And you, for the 22-year-old age group, besides that punk that called earlier, I think you rock, man.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. We'll
talk to you later. I appreciate it. It means a lot to me. I hosted, I forgot to mention that, the Anti-Bush Film Festival. That was held at the Majestic Theater down... almost downtown, the historic Majestic Theater, actually, where Harry Houdini performed his last act before dying there, outside of the place. The Anti-Bush Film Festival, I got on stage, and first off, I thought it'd be kind of the usual suspects, sort of the, you know, my friends in the anti-war movement. It'd be about 75 people or something like that. But I figured, what the hell, these, you know, support everything I can. There's 450 people there for the first show, right? And I got out on stage, and I'm not really, I mean, I don't do barn-burning speeches. I'm not a charismatic speaker or anything like that. And so I got up there, and I said, you notice, I said, welcome to the Anti-Bush Film Fest. I did not say, this is welcome to the first annual Anti-Bush Film Festival, because this will be the only one. It is the only one necessary. There will not be another one. And people just went crazy. I mean, to the point where I was startled. And I would say good portions of that audience as well were younger people. More compliments come from Eric, who listening in Windsor, Ontario, and he wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And this makes... I grabbed his letter because it made me think of a couple of things. He's, I'm a big fan of your WRIF show. This week, the CBC Channel 9 ran a special on the Fifth Estate program about Dick Cheney. Now, some of you know the Fifth Estate as the 40-year-old underground newspaper that I've been associated with for years. But this is a program called the Fifth Estate, part of the National, national news there. And they do investigative reporting. And he's includes a website. He says, take a look. You won't see this on Foxhole News or CNN. Now, it's on my website. And I happened to see this. I was in Canada on Wednesday night. I was stayed overnight in Canada, up in Grand Bend. And I was flabbergasted. And our last caller was saying he just recently started paying more and more attention to politics. And I mentioned right at the beginning of the show, talking to this Oakland County deputy, who said that he didn't have time to do the kind of investigations of the political situation that I do. And I said, yeah, well, for one thing, I'm hired to do that, although I would do it anyway. But it really takes a lot of effort. And if you would have, for the people, for the Canadians particularly, the few Americans, the people in the States here that saw this documentary on Dick Cheney, you wouldn't be debating whether he should be reelected or not, or elected, I guess, for the first time. You would be wondering why he's not in prison, why he hasn't been, you know, jailed for fraud and grand theft and any number of other crimes. Anyways, there is a version of this online. It's cbc.ca fifth, and there's some slashes in there. cbc.ca/fifth PeterWerby.com/Dick Cheney. Or you can go to my website, PeterWerby.com, PeterWerby.com, and go down to one of those delightful photographs of Dick Cheney. All right, we'll be right back.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
At First Horizon Home Loans, we know you go through a lot when you buy a home, and it can get a little nerve-wracking. From negotiating the price to inspections, even making sure repairs are made. But there's at least one thing that's a little less stressful. Getting your loan from First Horizon. We draw on the strength of a nationwide network of loan officers who will guide you every step of the way. First Horizon has all kinds of programs for all kinds of buyers. We'll help you select the one that best fits your needs so you can take care of other things, like choosing new furniture, designing a deck or patio. Well, you get the idea. We'll make it easy and give you the options you need. First Horizon Home Loans. Get home with less stress.
Call Mike Jenkins at First Horizon Home Loans today at 877-505-8600, extension 222, and get home with less stress. That's 877-505-8600, extension 222. Loan subject to credit approval, equal housing lender.
Getting ready to move into your new home? Got a business to relocate? Need help moving and packing delicate or fragile stuff? For your moving needs, don't bother calling the middleman when you can go straight to the boss. The professionals at Boss Moving and Service. Boss Moving and Service has been family owned and operated for over 20 years. They specialize in local moving with a fleet of 9 trucks. They carry a full line of packing materials. They're licensed by the state and fully insured. Boss is also your home and business relocation specialist. Whether it's one item, a piano, or organ, maybe a delicate antique or an entire truckload. Whatever you need to make your move go smoother, Boss Moving and Service has you covered. Compare Boss Moving's low prices to the other guys, and you'll learn what others in Metro Detroit have known for years. Don't mess with the middleman. Go straight to the boss. Call the professionals at Boss Moving and Service toll-free at 800-706-6644. Call today for a free in-home estimate at 800-706-6644. Remember, don't mess with the middleman. Go straight to the boss.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Hello.
How are you?
What you missed from Drew and Mike in the morning.
We talked to Coach Nick Saban after his loss to Auburn over the weekend, and we had to get his thoughts on his replacement, John L. Smith.
I think he's doing a fine job, but first of all, three words. Collagen rebuilding serum. If he's leading the Big Ten in anything, it's dead epidermal cells. I don't think 10 minutes in a tanning bed would kill the guy either.
Yeah.
Other than that, I don't like to pass advice along. I let the guy make his own mistakes.
Well, you know, he's pretty pasty looking, actually. You're right.
I think that's why he left Louisville. They used the gray for the coaching shirts, and he looked so washed out and ashy. I think a guy complected like that, at some point, has got to coach a team that has primary colors.
Well, Nick, not to bring this whole thing down, but what went wrong against Auburn?
Well, you mix together an unfamiliar 1875 Revlon with a Bumble and Bumble Stylers, throwing some unforeseen humidity, and that's what you get.
That's not like you to blame defeat on weather conditions, though.
I'm not talking about the game. I'm talking about that sweat-soaked, wind-blown mess on the top of my head.
Drew and Mike, the morning broadcast program on the Riff. 101. Riff. When it's 5 o'clock, it's time to rock with the Riff.
Weekday afternoons at 5, right here on 101 WRIF.
Your ride home rocks with Big Daddy Arthur P. Playing your Riff Rockin' Request. Call in your Riff Rockin' Request to the Grand Poobah at 313-298-WRIF.
Email them to arthurp@wrif.com.
Hell, you can even fax them in before you ditch the office at 248-398-6219. Call for the tunes that you want to hear. Win yourself some killer Riff swag and let the ride home rock with the Riff's own Big Daddy Arthur Penhalla.
Riff is the only station letting you pick your favorites and program the station 3 times a day at noon, 5, and 9.
It's your all-request Riff rock and ride home with Big Daddy Arthur P.
From the Motor City's one and only, home of rock and roll, 101 WRIF.
Riff.
This is WRIF.com.
Hello.
How are you?
What you missed from Drew and Mike in the morning.
We talk with Maury Povich.
Drew and Mike, you are not
the Father.
Oh, thank God.
That's great. We're going to use that time and time again in our life.
What is the longest and the most attempts it's taken to find the Father?
Periodically, we do these paternity updates.
They say you're the kind of regular guy that people would like to have a beer with. What a joke. You're an old money Yale going oil baron. The idea that you're a regular guy is outrageous. You turn our national surplus into the largest debt ever created, with the highest unemployment rate since the Great Depression, while multimillionaires are saving $1 million a year in taxes. I don't get it.
The terrorist one pipe you don't read. It's your head full of poppy seeds.
That's Jesus H. Christ, the band, with their song W. You know, I actually found, I saw an article that said something about conservatives were, you know, they were entering the fray as well. Because, you know, everybody we love in movies, everybody we love in music is all opposed to GW, right? So I thought, well, I'll give the other side. And I can't find this. But it wasn't anybody I even hardly knew of. I mean, they're just a bunch of nobodies. Anyways, let me remind you again, tomorrow the Sundance Channel is going to be broadcasting that television special, National Anthem Inside the Vote for Change Concert Tour. And it starts at 6:30. And it's going to have, you know, Bruce Springsteen and Pearl Jam, all those bands. And you can go to moveon.org. Even go to parties around your neighbor, wherever you're listening, anywhere in the country. I don't know anywhere in the world, but anywhere in the country, you put in your zip code at moveon.org. Go over the right side. It's also on my website as well. And you can hook up with people. All right, just a couple of emails. Let's see. Joel's listening in Gibraltar, Michigan, wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Love the show. Have you ever written a book or plan on writing one? Nope. Lots of articles, but no book. Stephen in Dearborn Heights writes, did you catch the answer Bush gave when he was asked by an audience member what kind of person he will be nominated for the next Supreme Court? He chuckled like an idiot and then said, I'm not telling. This is our president. Then he said he would get one in that would support him. I guess he was thinking of the way things went down in Florida, because that's what got him in, obviously. And also, he started saying he wasn't going to have anybody in there that would give their personal opinion. Like when he thought, hey, I know history. So he mentioned the Dred Scott decision, which I think was like in the 1830s or something like that. And he said, like, they gave their personal opinion on slavery. Dude, this was a slave state. Slavery was, you know, built into the Constitution. And every decision that had to do with slavery and then with segregation upheld that. Come on. What an idiot. Let's see here. Oh, now this guy is The Scarlet Pimpernel, a book I just read during the summer. He calls himself the Freeway Blogger, right? And if you go to the freewayblogger.com, I think, or Freeway Blogger, you know, BLOGGER, .com, you can see what he's up to. It's also on my website. He said, thanks for posting my site on yours. We have over 700 activists who are, and well past 1,000 come Wednesday. Now, what they're going to do, they put signs up on freeways. You just make your own, you know, no GW, or Bush lied, people died, and you paste it up on the freeway, and they're the most amazing signs. He said Phoenix, where the final debate will be that day, will be plastered, absolutely plastered. I'm good for an interview anytime you like. Hey, call him up. I don't want to air. I'll write it down. I can't give you the guy's cell number, can I? Let's see. 949. I don't know where that is. Okay. There it is, Dan. See if we can get him on the air here. All right, one more, and then we'll get back to your calls, maybe. This is a good question. Justin writing in from Orion, Michigan. Is that like Lake Orion? Hey, Peter, good show so far. Maybe you can tell over the air where to get yard signs, bumper stickers, and not by online means. You know, it is so tough trying to get Kerry bumper stickers. One thing is Republicans tear them down. But they need thousands and thousands more. Anybody listening, connected with the Democratic Party, get some damn lawn signs, people. Stop spending money on those stupid ads. Nobody watches or pays any attention to those on television. I mean, I keep going up to this Andy Meisner headquarters, 9 Mile Road in Ferndale. Never got them. They got a waiting list of like 150 people. All right. Let's go back to our callers. Hi, it's WRIF. You're on the air. Good evening.
Hi, this is Jim from Oak Park.
Hi, Jim.
Just wanted to say I am in the same 22 to 30 group. Most of my friends, they are voting Kerry because we know that we definitely need to change the way the country is going.
Mm-hmm.
Because we'll be the ones paying for all the crap that Bush has done to us. But I want to talk about the religious right. And
sure.
Basically, Bush's base, his voters, they're not all dumb. They're not all southern rednecks like some people think. But I think what ties them together is religion. And the extreme right wing, they believe into Jesus' return into Israel. And a lot of them think that the reason Bush went into Iraq is because Iraq's airspace is 6 minutes away from Israel's airspace. So in case something happens that our jets can get off the ground in Iraq, and which is a totally ridiculous argument because we got planes in Turkey and Saudi Arabia, too.
Well, they don't make a lot of sense. But what do you think about this? I walked through Oak Park and Pleasant Ridge and Ferndale, and you walk by these like boulevard streets in Pleasant Ridge. You got these $750,000 homes. They got carry signs on it. You go south of 9 Mile Road in Oak Park, and you got these $60,000 homes with Bush signs.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
What is up with that?
In Huntington Woods, it's the same thing. In Huntington Woods, it's people are, I think, mostly liberal. I've driven around there as well, and I noticed similar things. But, yeah, we don't have enough signs. I think I totally agree. In Oak Park, I'm the only guy on my street. Me and my neighbor are the only ones with the signs for Kerry, and there's no other signs for Bush either. So it takes me off that we are so inactive that people don't care that much overall. To show how much this matters, how much this election matters.
I think we might have a surprising turnout. And, yeah.
I hope you're right.
Well, yeah, and as it stands now, I think Kerry's going to win overwhelmingly. But that, I said earlier in the show that Bush and Cheney, and particularly the evil genius behind it all, if you can call it genius, Karl Rove, he's got to do something. They've got to come up with some big surprise. Now, on my website, I say that either they're going to bomb Iran or North Korea. They're going to start this big roundup of Arab Americans. I'm beginning to think that that's not going to happen because now they're worried they're going to lose the Muslim vote. They would lose that for sure, which would hurt them in Michigan and Florida. And what's the third thing? Oh, yeah, they're going to pull Osama bin Laden out of a hat. The other thing could be, like, they've got this destroyer in the Sea of Japan, very close to North Korea. So there's like, you know, shoot at us, shoot at us. But Bush has got to do something really sneaky and underhanded, because if he doesn't, he's a goner. And,
right, I totally agree.
Yeah.
Just to quickly get back to the religious issue, I think the religious right, they have an agenda. They want to get rid of Islam altogether, it seems like. They would be happy to see every Arabic country and every Muslim country bombed. And a lot of them think that's realistic, that the United States is actually going to do that.
Well, Bush might. Who knows?
And it's just ridiculous.
It is. All right, Jim, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Appreciate your call. Hey, we've got the freeway blogger on the line, the Scarlet Pimpernel. Hey, welcome to the Night Call Show.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I'm sorry I'm on a cell phone.
Well, it sounds all right right now. Tell us where you are.
Well, I'm in an undisclosed location in Southern California, in Orange County, of all places, and it's a hotbed of social rest here.
Social rest, not unrest. That's funny. Tell us, if you will, about your website go ahead.
I'll just tell you what I do.
Sure.
I decided a long time ago that the average American, that means me, just doesn't have a voice. And I was tired of listening to people telling me what I thought and what other Americans thought. And I thought, you know, I want to get my word out. So what I did is I started painting signs and putting them on the freeway. And I did it a lot. Over the last 2 years, I've put up about 2,000 signs against this war.
2,000? Wow.
Yeah, 2,000. Well, what I do is I use an overhead projector, and I can just crank them out at this point. But You know, anyone listening right now, if they wanted to reach 10,000 people tomorrow, all they'd have to do is make about two signs that were readable from the freeway and then place them with some degree of cleverness where they could be seen but not easily reached.
Mm-hmm. Now,
if they wanted to reach 100,000 people,
yeah,
they'd simply make 12 signs or 15 signs and do it like that.
Now, is this legal to do? There's always some question about that. In other words, you can have ads all along the freeway. You can have all these signs telling you, these LED signs flashing this and that, but you put something up there saying no war in Iraq, and they say you're causing a traffic diversion.
Oh, precisely. It's a visual distraction is the term they use, just like all the billboards are. But, you know, this is a case of Thomas Jefferson versus the Department of Transportation, as far as I'm concerned.
Have you ever been arrested for this?
Oh, never arrested. I've been clumsy enough to be stopped three times, and each time the kindly police officer said, look, I want you and your sign to get out of here.
Mm-hmm.
But seriously, when they gave us the right to free speech, that meant that each one of us could shout out as loud as we wanted to as many of our fellow citizens as possible.
All right, we only have a little bit of time left, so tell us how this, though, has expanded, and tell us about your website. Give us the URL for it anyways. I don't know if I said it right.
www.freewayblogger.com.
Yeah.
And on Wednesday the 13th, over 1,000 activists are going to be putting signs up on the freeway. And that is in 45 states so far and about 200 cities and suburbs.
Wow. Well, let's get some.
One of the biggest cities that's going to get hit, and I'm very proud of this, is going to be Phoenix, because Wednesday is when the debate is, and Phoenix is where it's going to be. And I just got word from a crew that they've got 70 signs ready, and there's another 25 people besides them who are going to be blogging Phoenix. So that's one city that's going to get just papered on Wednesday.
And they can do it in Detroit City here as well, huh?
You can do it in Detroit. You can do it anywhere. You know, all it takes is cardboard and some paint and something to say. And
well,
once we all start getting out there and just expressing ourselves directly, I think the face of politics in this country will be changed, and changed forever, and changed for the better.
Well, thank you so much, and you can go to your site, freewayblogger.com, or I have it on my site as well at peterwerby.com. Scarlet Pimpernel, thanks for joining us.
Hey, my pleasure, man.
All right, blog on. That's incredible. What did he say? The Orange County, Southern California, scene of social rest instead of unrest. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hey, Peter, how you doing?
Doing good.
Good. I'm calling. I'm actually a conservative, but I'm not calling to call you a name or anything. And I'm actually calling to agree with you on something.
What's that?
But I just want to point out something that you seem to be kind of rewriting history on. I agree with you on the Iraq War. It was a mistake.
A lot of conservatives agree with that.
Yep, it was. It wasn't necessary. It was attacking the wrong target. And but it's easy to say now in October 2004 that, you know, back then Hillary Clinton and John Kerry and everyone knew that there were no weapons of mass destruction. But I mean, everyone. I mean, the U.S., Germany, France, and yourself didn't know that.
Wait a minute. I knew there were no weapons of mass destruction. I mean,
I know, I know, and you said that tonight. But the thing is, you've got tape of your old shows.
Right.
I know you do.
Right, yeah, well.
And if you play them before the war, you said it at least half a dozen times. Do they have weapons of mass destruction? I don't know if they have weapons of mass destruction. I know they're not a threat, and I agree with that. They weren't a threat. And that war was a mistake. But you said it several times.
You're saying I said I don't know?
Definitely.
No.
No, you did. You did. It's on tape.
Well, I don't know. Listen, I'm so sure that I didn't say that, that I'm not even going to go back through them. If you have any tapes, please do it. But here's what I was depending on. That Scott Ritter, if you can go to commondreams.org, and he's got a major article on there today. He was a Marine who voted for Bush in 2000, even, and he was the head of the UN inspection team. And he assured the world that there weren't any. Also, all the sources were extraordinarily suspect that they came from Ahmed Chalabi and his whole, you know, Iraqi National Congress. Most of the stuff about, you know, it was well known that that the aluminum tubes from Niger were, you know, that was a phony story, and on and on and on. And the whole idea that that Bush discovered this right before the 2002 elections, when his poll numbers were plummeting, made it suspicious from the beginning. So I said there, and I also said they wouldn't be invading if they had any. Also, Bush's claim that they had these unmanned vehicles, air, whatever they were, that were going to attack the United States directly, that there were ships circling the world, was so preposterous that I can't believe anybody believed it. I don't think anybody did, other than the American people, who unfortunately put their trust in media and politicians.
Peter, I hear what you're saying, but there were several times when you said, are there weapons of mass destruction? I don't know. That's what the inspections are for. That's what we got to do. We got to go in there and find out. Do they have them? You know what you said? You said, they probably do. We sold them to them. I mean, they have them.
Wait. I could imagine the first part of it. I never would have said they probably did. The reason I've said this a million times, the reason that Bush attacked when he did is because the UN inspections were being extraordinarily successful. Hans Blix said that the Iraqis could have been better, but they were cooperative enough, and he needed another month. France said, let's give another month before we start this big major war. By another month, it would have become crystal clear that there weren't any weapons, and there was no pretext basis whatsoever from invading. So that is why Bush gave the go-ahead to attack. Had they had a weapon system comparable to what Tony Blair said, you know, they could, you know, ready to fire in 45 minutes, they never would have invaded. They wouldn't have taken the chance of having lost thousands of American troops.
Peter, I hear what you're saying, but at the time, back then, go back to it. Go back to your,
all right.
Go
what
back
I...
to the shows, and you were. Everyone was saying. No one was saying that there wasn't any weapons of mass destruction. We're right now. We are right now.
Well, you know what we're doing. We're arguing about facts, and which is a little difficult. You're saying I said something. I'm saying I didn't. Let's go back to the. You can go. Listen. You can go to whiterosesociety.org, and it's all right there. There's all the archives. All right, I got to go because my time is up for this segment of the show. Thank you so much, I guess. All right. Whew. Wow. All right. Got some very, very interesting interviews coming up after this break. Carolyn Nordstrom, who wrote a book called Shadows of War. And it's not just another book about war, and war is bad, war hurts people. You know, in fact, I started off talking about Edwin Starr's song, War, What Is It Good For? Absolutely Nothing. It actually works for considerable number of people. Then a fairly prestigious guest. I don't usually don't do prestigious guests, but former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine has written a book called On the Take, a very, very frightening look at how the medical establishment is getting paid off by the big pharmaceutical companies to essentially do their bidding and not to give the independent analysis and research that we need about the medicines that they're trying to shove down our throats. So it's going to be an interesting hour ahead. Stay tuned. Thanks for calling in. We'll talk next week.
This is the Riff Award-winning Night Call with Peter Werby. Peter will return with more Night Call in just a moment.
Good morning. This is Ray Vinson of American Equity Mortgage. If you're hearing our message at this time, it's probably because you're at work, driving around, or can't sleep. If you can't sleep, I hope it's not because of money problems, but if it is a money problem, American Equity Mortgage can help. You're not alone. The average household has a credit card debt of $6,000 or more and paying a fortune in interest. You see, if you're a homeowner, you can use the equity in your home to consolidate all your bills and have only one payment. Think about that, just one new low monthly payment. Your equity can be used to pay off your auto loans, credit cards, and get a new low fixed rate on your mortgage. You will be saving hundreds of dollars each month. American Equity Mortgage specializes in homeowners with less than perfect credit. We have helped thousands of people just like you get back on track. You can call our office right now, and a loan specialist will call you first thing in the morning. That's American Equity Mortgage. Call toll-free, 888-71-LOAN-1, 888-71-L-O-A-N, then the number 1.
Why are men all over America talking about Testosterpro? Listen.
After I tried Testosterpro, I felt like I was the man I wanted to be. I wish I'd found out about it sooner because I feel like I'm more of a man now than when I was younger.
I'm Dr. Richard Cohen, MD, men's health specialist. In many men, testosterone levels can fall rapidly after age 35. But now there's Testosterpro, the complete performance boosting system I designed for men who are starting to feel their age. If you don't feel like the man you used to be, call now for a 30-day risk-free trial of the Testosterpro system, which includes my bonus report on aging and its effects on energy, sex drive, and stamina, free with your order.
Call now for your confidential trial of Testosterpro. 1-800-897-3124. 1-800-897-3124. Results will vary. 1-800-897-3124. Guaranteed or your money back. 1-800-897-3124.
Hey, truck owners, Meltdown here, and when I think of trucks, I think of the undisputed Chevy truck king, Joe Pagnon Chevrolet. October is Chevy Truck Month, and to celebrate Trucktoberfest, Joe Pagnon has overloaded his lot with new Chevy Colorados, Suburbans, Tahoes, Silverados, Avalanches. Joe Pagnon has hundreds of Chevy trucks on over 9 acres all ready for immediate delivery. And believe me, they'll hook these bad boys up for you. Fat tires, chrome rims, super-powered electronics, rumbling exhaust. You'll roll off Joe Pagnon's lot styling. And hey, winter's right around the corner. If you work from your truck, they have them set up with racks, plows, spreaders, whatever you need to get the job done this winter. The 23rd annual Trucktoberfest celebration is on, so don't miss out because Joe Pagnon has it all. Get to Joe Pagnon Chevrolet in Southfield right at 696 and Telegraph, or call the unbeatable dealer toll free and ask about all the great rebates at 866-JOE-1111 for all the details, or on the web at theunbeatabledealer.com. Silverado, the right truck.
This is NICO. Now, here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. I can't begin to tell you, listening audience, how many books on war, about wars, war in general, specific wars, particularly, as you can imagine, the Iraq War, every week that come into the studio here at the radio station. And I've interviewed some of the authors about them, but most of them have a similar thread to them. War is bad, obviously, and I'll get back to the obviously in a second, and particularly the Iraq War, where we have any number of authors saying that the pretext for the Iraq War was false. But you, particularly those of you listening right here in Detroit, the Motown great Edwin Starr saying, "War, what is it good for? Absolutely nothing." And one would think that would be the case. Who in the world would want war? Well, an extraordinary book came across my desk. It's called Shadows of War, Violence, Power, and International Profiteering in the 21st Century. It's written by Carolyn Nordstrom. She's an associate professor of anthropology at the University of Notre Dame, and she's also the author of A Different Kind of War Story, the co-editor of Fieldwork Under Fire, Contemporary Studies of Violence and Survival, and The Paths to Domination, Resistance, and Terror. And these are all published by the University of California Press, as is Shadows of War. Welcome, Carolyn Nordstrom, to the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And now, what I was saying, Edwin Starr, is, you know, war, what is it good for? Absolutely nothing. You would think that everyone on the planet would just abhor it, but it does work for some people, doesn't it?
It does work for some people. There's no question about it.
Give us some examples.
First, let me tell you how I came to study war. I am an anthropologist, and most people don't think of anthropologists as studying war zones. They think of studying, you know, Indiana Jones-type stuff or, you know, ancient civilizations. But people on the front lines are cultures, they're societies, and that's what we study. So my specialty is trying to figure out how people survive on the front lines. Who's out there? What is going on? Who's doing what to whom? So I literally have spent half my career on the front lines of various wars around the world. And I'm a scientist. I mean, I'm not there to try to prove a point. I'm not there to support one side or the other. I'm there to do scholarship to do science.
Well, there is a pattern to your books. I was going to note that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And when did this all come about? You said that you've been doing this for half your professional life.
Yeah.
At some point you said, I'm not going to go to Utah and
pick up arrowheads.
Yeah, right. I want to go into some fire zone. What was the original motivation?
It was, I can tell you the day it happened, and it was in 1983. I was in Sri Lanka, and I was studying medical systems, and I got caught in severe political violence. The country blew. It was these terrible riots. 1/6 of the entire country was destroyed in 7 days, and I wasn't sure I was going to live through it. But I discovered two things. I discovered you can study war, which I did to survive it, and I discovered I had a gift for it. I'm just really calm on the front lines in the middle of a firefight. And there's patterns, and those patterns are culture, and that's what anthropologists do. So, you know, going back to your question about who profits, you know, I could tell you stories of average families. You know, you're a mom or you're a dad, and your 14-year-old son or daughter gets beaten up, tortured, and killed. What do you do? Some people turn to the Red Cross, some people turn to church, and some people turn to fighting. And for these people, that's a really legitimate thing to do. Whether we like it or not, if you shoot someone's family member, they probably will fight back, whether it's in Iraq or Burma or Colombia, and nothing's going to change that equation. But what's scary is that person has to buy a gun. And one of the things I've charted is the vast global system of weapons transfers and all that goes into making those weapons transfers possible. And people need money to buy weapons. So very, very poor people will sell anything they can, human labor, diamonds, blood diamonds, gold, coltan, which we use in our cell phones. It's a mineral that you find in Congo. They'll sell anything that they can at their fingertips to buy weapons. And when you start adding all this up, you're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars yearly going into this kind of war economy around the world. And those hundreds of billions are going into very powerful people's pockets.
So this is also part of the world economy. It's not just, we would all say, gee, it's unfortunate that there's wars. On the other hand, it's a very distinct part of international commerce.
You know, this is a great point. I love the way you say that, because actually I've been adding up how much it actually sums up to. And literally, it is huge. If you figure the world legal economy is somewhere between $33 and $37 trillion, you're figuring maybe 1/30th of that is going into war products. And another, if you just double that, is going into all the supplies behind war, the uniforms, the penicillin, all the things you need to keep an army and a population alive at war. But one of the big wild cards here is a lot of this goes on illegally.
Mm-hmm.
Huge amounts of this is not charted, and therefore it's a lot of money and a lot of power we don't control legally.
Well, if you think about it, too, I just had this thought, is that it's part of, in a sense, discretionary spending. In other words, you took the world economy, what's necessary for one to survive,
mm-hmm.
And you have to spend that. But then the rest of it, what can you buy then? I mean, well, we want to buy, I don't know, one of these little things that go beep, you know,
yeah.
These little computers and stuff like that. But also, I think if you put war material in there and just had this whole large discretionary spending area, it would probably even amount to a significantly larger chunk of the world economy.
Ooh, you are good at this, you know. That's actually something that's very hard for me to get across. But I actually went onto the front lines and began to go with the truckers and the pilots and the black marketeers that carry this stuff in and out of war zones. I went to the ports and talked to the shippers and the black marketeers and all of these people that make this possible. And you are spot on correct, because what do you need in a war zone? You don't just need a weapon. You need communication systems. Well, that means computers. That means software. That means a ton of stuff that average industries are churning out all over the world. So, yes, Sony and Mercedes-Benz and all the software companies and Windows are also making a fortune, because you have to have this stuff at war zones.
Mm-hmm.
And no local industries are working because they're all bombed out. So they have to buy it from Shanghai and Singapore and San Francisco.
Carolyn Nordstrom is my guest on the Peter Werby Show. Her book is Shadows of War, and the shadows, this is what we're talking about. We're talking about the shadows. We see the war and the results of it every night on television. Let's get back a little. You started to fascinate me a bit about your personal history. Chris Hedges, whose book, the name always escapes me, about war. Do you remember New York? Remember the name of it?
Sorry.
Okay, well, it's my job. I'm supposed to know.
Thank you. Got me off the hook.
Yeah. Anyways, book about being a war correspondent, and also war photographers. Ultimately, they say they like being there. They like the juice. And would Carolyn Nordstrom be happy if you were just examining, we said arrowheads before, but kind of very interesting Inuit cultures up in Alaska or wherever? Or is this, at some level, is this enjoyable, or is that the word we would use for it?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that, because I get this a lot, that somehow there's a real rush to war, and in some ways that's really dangerous, because people who haven't been in war zones then translate that into, well, people in war zones can't have it that bad if there's something fun, something juicy about it. I was really lucky, because I walked into war zones without planning to study them. I walked into a place that was supposed to be paradise. It was Sri Lanka, to study medicine. But I walked in having worked in emergency rooms, in medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And a doctor walks into an emergency room to make things better. They don't walk in and say, oh, man, there's this high rush, or, oh, God, I'm getting this cheap adrenaline thrill. They walk in and say, I can make a difference in the world. And, I'm really lucky, because I took that right into war with me. So I really don't have that juice thing that so many people talk about. And that's good, because I've done this now for 20 years, and I haven't burned out. Because I walk in and I see mom, dad, and the kids, and their little kid just stepped on a landmine, or dad just got blown up, or mom just got raped and tortured, and there isn't any juice to that. That's just really sad. It's like watching someone die from cancer, or watching someone die from getting hit in a car accident. And what you do is just try to make the world a little bit better. So I think I'm lucky.
Well, on the other hand, you must have... Well, whenever people do something that the rest of us think is brave, I've never heard anybody say, yes, it was very brave on my part, or it did take a lot of courage. But when I read through Shadows of War, and I see you talking about jumping on these supply planes and being in Mozambique and all that, and if you called me and said, hey, Pete, we're off to, I'd say, write me. I mean, there's no way, and I'm very serious, there's no way in the world would I think to go to some of these places and go through the conveyances, like a supply plane. Maybe just give us an example from the book. I remember you were talking in the book about going on some of these supply planes. I think it was in Mozambique, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. What? I actually have done that in many countries, because it's a wonderful way to travel.
But it must have some peril attached to it as well.
I think the thing is, you're right, we don't tend to think of ourselves as doing anything courageous, because the first thing you discover is that there's a remarkable community in a war zone. These pilots, honest to God, they're amazing. I would love to do a book on them alone. These are crusty old war horses who get on into planes that are completely rattle-trapped, held together with bubble gum and duct tape, and they fly 7 runs a day, overloaded dangerously, to take food out to people who've just been bombed out. And so, when I jump on a plane and they give me a ride and I go out there to interview these people, I think more about these pilots than I do about myself, because they're doing this day in and day out for years.
Hmm.
They're making... Now, a lot of these guys are nuts, but they're wonderfully nuts, and they are making such a difference, and no CNN crew, no sort of New York Times ever gets out there to document these guys. And they're really amazing. So we tend to think of them as being sort of the, a lot of the NGOs are out there, Save the Children, CARE. I mean, working on the front lines, digging up landmines, taking care of little babies who just got a leg blown off. And nobody ever, gives them the time. They make like $5 a day. So there's some real heroes out there. You don't ever feel like you're doing too much, because there's so many cool people out there making a difference.
Well, it does. I mean, actually, given my beliefs about peace and social justice, in a sense, it does make me a little ashamed. That is that I, those people are really walking the walk, whereas, like I say, if someone said, here, you can actually be one of those people that are trying to make a difference, that are trying to stop landmines, that are any number of things out there where I've interviewed so many people, I wouldn't go. So there must be some component there that they have that I don't.
Well, you do, actually, and I've got a quick story for you that'll make you feel good. There's a wonderful movie about two women, but it's a theme that comes up over and over again. Two best friends who go to war, and one chooses to become a commander on the front lines, and the other chooses to become a journalist. And what the whole movie is about is that each one is critical, because if you don't get information out to people, if you don't tell the truth, the world doesn't change. So what you're doing is actually an incredibly important part of the whole process.
Folks, that's why I invited Carolyn Bergstrom on. No, actually, we're talking about her incredible book, Shadows of War, Violence, Power, and International Profiteering in the 21st Century. And tell us a little more about the shadows. The shadows mean is what we don't see.
Mm-hmm,
we
absolutely
talked a little about the economic aspects of it. Mm-hmm. What else is in the shadows?
There's a lot that takes place in the shadows, and the economics is really big, because without a weapon, you don't have a war. But there's a lot that people never talk about. For example, 90% of all casualties today are civilians. The majority of these are women and children. In the world today, more children are tortured than adult soldiers. Now, these are things that no army wants to admit. It goes on. It goes on worldwide. It's not one country worse than the other. It's a pattern that's taking place sort of globally today. But it's a pattern that won't change until people begin to become outraged. But they can't become outraged. And this, again, goes back to the whole point of journalism. They can't become outraged until people know what's really going on. Well, what military is going to admit they just bombed out a whole city or tortured a 12-year-old boy or girl to get information? So the shadows covers a whole lot of atrocities and war realities that people just don't want known.
Well, tell us about some of what fuels this world economy of war as well. You mentioned diamonds in a couple of different contexts.
Mm-hmm. I started out actually with diamonds because I realized that whatever war zone I went to on whatever continent, I was seeing the same arms merchants and profiteering taking place. I mean, they'd be selling in one country, they'd be selling in the next country, and I was seeing the same group of people moving around the world. So I began to sort of chart what was going on, and okay, what war zone has a currency people want to use on an international market? Almost none, because the currencies collapse. So to get weapons, to get penicillin, to get food, to get whatever it is you need, communication systems, people have to sell something that people want on the international markets. Well, blood diamonds are great. Diamonds are easy to transport. They're wonderful to, move right into an international economy. So those buy weapons really easily. So is gold. So do minerals, zinc, coltan. It's really interesting, though, timber, seafood, human labor,
really?
Kids working in agriculture. It's a huge industry in 12 to 14-year-old boys and girls who will go into another country and work in agricultural fields, make carpets, sex industry, sadly enough. So anything that will get you money on the international market to buy what you need is fuel in the war economy. And a lot of this, of course, again, just like human rights violations, people don't want known.
Mm-hmm. Tell us, though, specifically about the phrase blood diamonds. I'm not sure everyone is familiar with that.
Blood diamonds, it started in some of the wars in Africa, which took place in really great, rich diamond-mined areas. And what would happen is that the war would literally take place around the diamond mines, each side fighting to control the diamond mines. Because you could, they figure a country like Angola, which had a war end in 2001, but during the decades before that, they figured $1 million a day in diamonds alone were leaving the country illegally. $1 million a day.
Now, could those wind up in this country, or do they?
They wind up on your girlfriend's engagement ring.
Now, actually, one of the reasons I asked that is neighbors of ours are getting married. And both of them did not want blood diamonds, and so they were trying to get diamonds that were certified from Canada. Is there a way to actually know the origins of the diamonds you're buying?
The truth is I've literally gone to these certification seminars in war zones. Okay, the official line is, yes, you can certify. But if you do the work I do, which is you talk to the smugglers, you talk to the forgers, the truth is, no, because any smuggler and forger worth their weight in gold or diamonds can whip out those certifications in 5 seconds. So the truth is these diamonds are shot throughout the legal economy. Much of the certification is completely illegal.
That's depressing. Very depressing. Carolyn Nordstrom is my guest. She's the author of Shadows of War. It's published by the University of California Press. We talked earlier about all the different, or are there all the different countries you've been in? What are the countries you've been in where there has been war and that you've been looking at for your now fourth book on war?
Well, I started out in Southern Asia, Sri Lanka, India, Southeast Asia. Then I moved over to do some comparison in Southern Africa, spent time in the Balkans, traveled a bit through South America. I've actually, 20 years on the road, you cover a lot of countries.
Yeah, you said that it doesn't bring juice or that it doesn't have that kind of adrenaline that sometimes you get some people saying that life in those war zones provide. But how about the opposite effects? I mean, when I was just at a film festival last night, and they had photographs of children in Iraq that were just injured so badly, and I couldn't even. I spent most of the time looking at the ground. I couldn't even take looking at the photographs. And you've seen, I assume, numerous dead people, dead children, dead
That's
soldiers.
Right. Oh yeah.
Doesn't that kind of weigh on the psyche after a while?
That's one question I'm really glad you asked, because there's one thing that's really important for me to get across when I talk about what I've found on the front lines, and this is the most surprising thing. Most of us in the Western world have kind of grown up on a sort of a public, it's just general public viewpoint that it's kind of a dog-eat-dog world out there, that in the violence of the front lines, people become animals, and they'll just rape and kill and plunder because there's no control. The amazing thing is I have found this is completely wrong. I have found that on the front lines, the vast majority of people become incredibly good.
Really?
Now, I have documented this. I have thousands of examples. Most people on the front lines set up trade routes to places that have been bombed out, set up midnight hospitals in the middle of fields when people are bombing the regular hospitals to try to destroy morale. People are setting up clean water systems. They're taking care of one another. They're setting up schools under trees when the schools have been bombed out. Most people become astoundingly good. They really try to regenerate their communities and set up healing systems for broken bodies and broken communities and broken everything in the most amazingly sort of valuable and value-full ways. So, yeah, I've seen a lot of really horrible things, but what gives me balance is I've actually seen more good than the average person ever does in their life.
Well, yeah.
That gives me such hope.
I guess in such intense situations that rather if we don't have to decide either paper or plastic or which channel to turn, when those decisions really are about life and death. And I often wonder when I read about war zones and the chances that people take, and like I was saying earlier, I was thinking, man, I don't know what I would do. I think that when you're really faced with it, that most people do rise to the occasion.
They do.
Yeah, yeah.
And beautifully. I mean, with astounding creativity. I mean, people really come up with beautiful solutions to really difficult situations.
You talk in your book about Shadows of War about ethnographies, which is a rather academic term, about ethnography. Ethnography. Don't laugh at me.
I'm laughing with you.
You're my guest. I can't say it now.
Ethnographies.
Ethnographies of war. Those are what? Those are essentially, just as you said, looking at people and how cultures and subcultures are created in that context?
Anthropologists who study culture. There's two kinds of anthropologists, those who study the dead, like Indiana Jones, and those who study the living, like Margaret Mead. So those of us who study the living, you're right, it's just a jargony term we call it ethnography, but all it means is going out into a community and figuring out how people live their lives. What do they value? What do they think about? What do they do during their day? So I just go out under the front lines and do that.
Well, how about in areas like the Balkans or in Angola? I mean, talk about totally reconfiguring life as people once knew it. This war situation has completely altered life for so many different peoples around the world. And sometimes maybe internally, good, like we love all Serbs, but we hate all, everybody else outside. There must be a mix as well.
You know, it's interesting because one of the things I've been finding out is that I've been really literally redefining the very definition of violence. Because we've tended in our societies to think of violence as harm to the physical body. But one of the things I'm finding out is that you can actually harm a society. And if you kill enough people, if you do enough damage in terms of torture or indiscriminate bombing or the killing of children, you know, you shock people. You really mess them up. Soldiers who kill are truly messed up. I mean, they figure that a good 95% of soldiers are really emotionally damaged by just being in war. As much as they're soldiers and in many places they're heroes, in some places they're dogs, depending on your point of view, it doesn't matter. They're still damaged. And, of course, and see, this is where this whole point of the good comes in, because people literally have to not only put back together damaged bodies, they have to rebuild damaged societies. So, you know, a society coming out of war, and we see this in Iraq, of course, has to answer not only how do you remake a community? How do you rebuild an educational system? How do you rebuild a justice system? You know, how do you get your media back up and running and honest? What's democracy and how do you make it work? You know, so these are critical things going on as a war sort of tries to solve itself.
Yeah, and you're hopeful about all of that. That's good. That's good. I have not been very hopeful about much lately. And the damage that's been inflicted on so many traditional societies by the seemingly endless war often doesn't give me much room for hope. But since you're closer to it, you've been in these areas, I'd like to hear that.
I am hopeful. If you look at the... See, as an anthropologist, I have a view of history that's several million years long. And we go through cycles of war where mostly young men go out and kill each other in trenches like the First World War. Two really dangerous eras like we're in today where mostly civilians get killed because the war is taking place in city centers. This is why I think journalism is so important, because people pretty much are outraged when you start killing average families. But you got to get the idea out there that war is changing today and we've got to do something about it or we will destroy the fabric of our world.
Hmm.
So I'm hopeful that people care. It's just getting them the information so they can do something about it.
Well, this is what Richard Goldstone, former chief prosecutor of the International War Crime Tribunal for Rwanda and the former Yugoslavia, has to say about your book. This is a gripping account of what the author calls research into the shadows, the often dangerous world of the powerful and wealthy who inhabit global extra-governmental organizations. It is also about the dehumanizing effects of war and violence on the victims. This book provides a rare opportunity of, quote, being there with a courageous and highly observant anthropologist. And he says, I highly recommend it. Thank you so much, Carolyn Nordstrom, for being with me. The book, again, Shadows of War, Violence, Power, and International Profiteering in the 21st Century. And I will have this up on my website. Right now, it's just ucpress.edu. Carolyn, is there a direct web address for this? Or I'll find it and put it up there for you.
That would be lovely, because I'm actually not at a computer right now. I really don't know.
Thank you so much for joining me.
And thank you for asking me. I appreciate it.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Rayburn Golf Club. Rayburn. When do those leaks start again?
Are you done yet? You said 5 minutes. That was an hour ago. Are you avoiding me?
Daddy. Can I try? Is it my turn yet?
I can't swing the club with you on it.
Rayburn, take me away.
Rayburn Golf Club in Plymouth, home of the Monster, a 617-yard par 5 double dogleg, an 18-hole championship course known for its fast undulating greens. It has one of Michigan's toughest public golf holes with a driving range, restaurant, and tavern. They even have PGA pros on site for lessons and a great pro shop. The only thing they don't have is...
Enough already. Must be nice to have that kind of time. Could you get in here and help with dinner?
Please, let it be time for Brayburn's leagues to start.
Brayburn Golf Club in Plymouth has you covered. Call 800-714-6700. That's 800-714-6700. 2005 league openings are now available, so call Brayburn Golf Club in Plymouth and get at least one night a week you can count on just for you and your buddies. 1-800-714-6700.
Brayburn.
Dumpster street.
Honey, wake up. You're having a nightmare, honey.
Huh? Oh, wow.
That was no nightmare. I was having an incredible fantasy.
Really? A fantasy? So, was I involved?
Yeah, you were so hot and all sweaty. You were really getting the job done.
Yeah, well, you know me. I always come through for you. What was all that dumpsters for you stuff? You kept on repeating that, dumpsters for you.
Dumpsters for you is the dumpster service you were using when you finally got around to cleaning out that junk that I've been bugging you about.
That's your fantasy. Me calling dumpsters for you and loading our junk from the house projects? If that's all it takes to get you excited, where's their number?
248-388-6648. That's 248-388-6648. Or go to dumpstersforyou.com. Dumpsters, the number 4, the letter U.
You know it's all about you, honey.
Call tomorrow. I've got other plans right now.
Dumpsters for you, or for pleasing her, whatever it takes. Dumpsters for You is there to help. Dumpstersforyou.com.
WRIM.com.
Hello.
How are you?
What you missed from Drew and Mike in the morning.
We talk with Brenda Warner, whose husband Kurt is having a great season thus far with the Giants.
I told the Giants when they got Kurt that they were really signing both of us. Kind of like when Bill and Hillary were co-presidents. We're like co-quarterbacks. And it works.
So how'd you get Kurt to find himself?
You know, I yelled at him until I was blue in the face, but I didn't really have a breakthrough until I sat him down and broke down film, went over coverages.
Well, okay, who do you play this weekend?
We're at Lambeau, and just to give you an idea about how well we're playing right now,
yeah.
We just happen to have the highest over number in the league this week. Bet the house on the over. And just between you, me, and the pit boss, take the Giants and the points. I think we're a strong road team on grass.
Thanks for the tip, Brenda. Those overs make me nervous, so I gotta tell you.
Oh, awesome. Honey, dip it then. I dip that puppy all day. Get your over down to 38.
It's a pleasure to be with you. What is more important to us than our health? It's almost a cliche, something money can't buy, something that all of us as Americans are extraordinarily concerned with. We talk about having the best health care system in the world, yet so many of us suffer so many different ills. We take so many pills. It's all so expensive. There's more people and more percentage of our population that are uninsured than any industrial country in the world. And we've done lots of shows on these topics, and also the astronomical profits of the drug companies, how their millions and billions allow them to influence politics. But I want to bring a man, an author, to our microphones who has a different perspective on all of this. The book is called On the Take: How Medicine's Complicity with Big Business Can Endanger Your Health. And the author is Jerome P. Kasserer. He is a distinguished professor at Tufts University School of Medicine, an adjunct professor of medicine at Yale University School of Medicine. And he's been the editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine for more than 8 years. Dr. Kasserer, thanks for joining me.
Pleasure to be with you, Peter.
You're no longer the editor, though, right, of the New England?
Correct. I was from 1991 to 1999.
This book of yours, which essentially talks about, on the take, I mean, right away, talks about corruption, the corruption of the medical profession by money. This couldn't make you too popular.
Yeah, I didn't write it to be popular, I'm afraid. What I've done is really kind of documented what I believe is an ethically challenged profession. I would be first to say that it's not everybody that's ethically challenged. It's perhaps a fraction of the profession, but it's serious and problematic.
Yeah, so, describe just the nature of this. I mean, it's quite widespread that you document in your book On the Take, and it has different aspects. But how is medicine's complicity with big business endangering our health?
Well, the complexity of the relationships between physicians and industry is a start at looking at it. The first point is that doctors are given gifts, they're given lunches and dinners, and their education is being paid by industry. They are engaged with industry as consultants, and they are involved with industry and as lecturers for the companies. They hold patents on certain drugs, and all of these financial relationships can lead to two important consequences, or perhaps more than two, but two important, at least two important consequences. One is that it can harm individual patients. It can harm classes of patients. It can also influence in a negative way the medical information that doctors get from various sources, journals and lectures and so forth. And finally, it can raise the cost of medical care because of the fact that the advertising generally leads to the use of the newest and most expensive drugs.
Now, maybe we should flesh some of this out, because
sure,
on the face of it, the description doesn't speak of corruption directly. In fact, we're told that very frequently that doctors are confronted with so many medical choices in terms of what pharmaceuticals that they can prescribe, is that if it wasn't for the salespeople, if it wasn't for the pitches, that they couldn't even keep track of it. So that the relationship isn't inherently corrupt, or is it?
Well, of course, you know, we have 87,000 drug salesmen out there every year trying to promote their own products, and there's pretty good evidence that they that the information that they give doctors is not always completely and totally objective, and it's also true that the information that people get from lectures that are sponsored by drug companies are not always objective. And what I'd like to see is, I'd like to see doctors get their information from places and publications that are not tainted by drug money.
Mm-hmm. Now, you are or have been a practicing physician, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, and so how did, in your own practice, how did this come about, and what did you face, and what were your decisions? To give us an example.
Well, I think I described in the book one example that was really quite eye-opening to me. When I was a young physician, just starting out in practice, I published a paper about certain kinds of drugs, diuretic drugs, and suddenly I was latched onto by one of the big pharmaceutical companies and asked to become a speaker for them, which I did. And it was very seductive because I was making $700 for every lecture I gave, and they would fly me around the country, and they never asked me to say anything about their drug. So I went along and was doing fine, and then finally they asked me to come to Madison Avenue and learn how to do TV slots. I did that, and then at the very end they said, well, you're all ready to do videos for us now, and all you have to do is mention the name of our drug once. And I said, wait a minute, I don't do that. That was the end of my involvement with that company. They didn't call me much after that. So these relationships are insidious. When you're giving a lecture for a drug company, if you're not sympathetic to their cause, which is their marketing cause, they may not ask you again. And that's the kind of seduction. $700 then was probably worth $2,000 now. And there are plenty of doctors that are out there giving lectures for drug companies at that kind of rate. And there is a relationship between the money you get and some kind of obligation for reciprocity.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Kassir, how would you have been compromised if you simply would have said, yes, take brand X or brand X diuretic is actually a wonderful product? How would that have compromised you?
It might have compromised me to say more positive about the drug than was appropriate. It might have also compromised me by forgetting or neglecting to talk about the risks of certain drugs. And we've had lots of examples in the recent past of instances where the validity of information that came out to the public was questioned because of these relationships. For example, a couple of weeks ago there was a lot of publicity about the lack of publishing negative studies. There was another example of the cholesterol guidelines, and another example, most recently, of Vioxx.
Mm-hmm.
And in every one of those instances, there's a question of whether, in some way, the medical information was influenced by a conflict of interest.
Sure. Well, tell us, because some of these recommendations are interesting, because then, as you show in your book On the Take, some of these people wind up to be on the board of the organization that they're endorsing.
Yeah. Well, one very specific example that I give in the book is a drug called Regulin, which was introduced for the treatment of diabetes, and it was a kind of a new drug, and it was a really exciting drug. It was introduced at the National Institutes of Health, and it turned out that the person who was running the study had patents on the drug. It turned out after a period of time that there was toxicity of the drug, there's liver damage occurred as a consequence of the drug. It came before the FDA several times. In the meantime, the British equivalent of the FDA took it off the market, but it remained on the market in the United States. And later on, there had been some 30-some deaths. It was reviewed again by the FDA and continued on the market. Finally, one of the review groups that looked at the toxicity of the drugs, it turned out that that almost all of the people on the review committee had an arrangement with Warner Lambert, the company that made the drug.
Hmm.
They kept it on the market. Finally, in the year 2000, it was removed from the market after 60 people died or so. And there's a lot of litigation about that now in the courts. Now, do we know that those people, the majority of people on that committee who were involved with Warner Lambert in some consulting arrangement, do we know if their opinion was influenced by their financial connection? We don't. But it's worrisome. And what we'd like to have involved in those decisions are people who do not have financial arrangements.
You would think so. Jerome P. Casura is my guest. He's a professor of medicine, also a doctor himself. He's written a book for Oxford University Press, On the Take, How Medicine's Complicity with Big Business Can Endanger Your Health. Now, you were the editor for 8 years in the 90s of the prestigious New England Journal of Medicine, something that has that cachet of absolute trust and confidence, and it sounds like that's what you tried to maintain during your stint there. But you allowed physicians to write certain kinds of articles only if they were free from any financial involvement. Did that prove to be difficult at all, or when people were confronted with that, other doctors or researchers, what was their reaction?
Well, Peter, there basically are two kinds of articles that we focused on. One was scientific articles, where the investigator gives you all the information, all the data. And in those articles, it really doesn't matter whether somebody has a financial conflict of interest because they've given you the data. Of course, unless they're lying, and you know, in general, that doesn't happen. But there are articles where, such as review articles where you review a condition or review a drug, or opinion pieces like editorials where the author really picks and chooses from the literature the kinds of information he uses. And in those circumstances, what you want to do, at least what we wanted to do, was to have people write those who did not have financial arrangements with industry. And it became increasingly difficult over the years that I was there to find people who didn't have a financial conflict. And that's one of the things that alerted me to the fact that this was becoming more problematic.
What were the reaction, though? I mean, was it, what's the matter with this Casura guy? Is he, is he being a little too hard line on this? I mean, did you get that kind of reaction?
Well, yes. It turned out the policy of not allowing people to write review articles and editorials if they had a financial conflict is one that my predecessor, Arnold Relman, had instituted. I just continued it. But when we turned people down for writing such articles, they were sometimes furious with us. Now, it turned out that my predecessor, Jeff Drazen, at the Journal, felt that it was just too impossible to get people, and he loosened up the policy, now allows some people to write these articles if they have conflicts, and simply discloses their the conflict. And you know, that to me, that is not an ideal approach, but I can understand why he did it.
Mm. You know, this is sort of a broader question. I just had this thought while we were discussing this specific issue. 50 years ago, most of the major institutions of this society were well-respected, including a lot of its operatives, Congress, politicians in general, the police, medicine. The list is endless. And now we're almost getting this picture of corruption at every at every point, other than like firemen. It turns out that firemen now are the most respected people in the country. Is there any thought of, or do you treat in your book On the Take what it does overall to the to this prestige that medicine should enjoy?
Well, you're absolutely right about the decline in prestige. We've even seen in recent years the decline in prestige of major news organizations, including.
Oh, I forgot about that. Yes,
well, newspaper and television. You know, most recently.
And radio. I should have done full disclosure here.
Right? Well, poor Dan Rather having gotten stuck in a big mistake. The fact is that if you look at the newspapers from day to day, it is unbelievable how often you come across conflicts of interest in just about every walk of life. And part of it is, I have to say, is generated by the fact that we allow our major legislators to be bought by special interest groups. The lobbying that goes on and the kind of influence that is exacted by money is absolutely astonishing. It's not only by the way, politicians. It's in many different circumstances. But as you read the papers from day to day, you find that there's an enormous amount of conflict of interest, a financial conflict of interest. And I think that if you look at how this all developed in medicine, I'm quite convinced that part of it is just a reflection of what goes on in society.
Mm-hmm. You know, it is possible, I'm sure you would agree, that that this can be supervised, because I was thinking about the broadcast industry that I take part in. Every year I have to sign an affidavit that I have not taken any payola, that I have not taken any money to play any records, or I suppose nobody's given me any money to interview any authors or anything like that. And this is regulated by the Federal Communications Commission because of the scandal. What was it now, 25, 30 years ago, something like that, when payola and plugola were the big deal? And, I mean, I can't even let a record company take me out to lunch.
Aha, now you've come to what I think is the critical point. And that is that doctors shouldn't be in the same circumstance. Why should just think about this? Why should journalists, radio people like yourself, why should they have a higher standard than doctors? I mean, it is ridiculous. Doctors should have the highest standard because they deal with human life, and they deal with the private secrets of people. I mean, that seems to me to be an overwhelming difference between what doctors do and what firemen do. I mean, firemen, at least, they risk their lives. But doctors have this special relationship. They're supposed to supposed to put the patient first, not their pocketbooks first.
Well, there should be, of course, and we can maybe come to that at the end of our discussion, which is coming up in just a few minutes, about what kind of remedial steps can be taken. But on the individual level, more and more is being put off, and maybe for the good, on the patient, because
right.
It used to be just whatever doctor said, you would just pop in your mouth. Whereas now, we all have these physicians' desk references of our own. They're little drug books. We look up, and what's the, you know, is there any, what are the side effects and what have you. And for instance, my wife needed an anti-inflammatory that did not upset her stomach recently, and she was prescribed Bextra. Mm-hmm. But she could have just as easily had Vioxx prescribed for her, right?
Sure.
How does one know what one's physician is basing their prescriptions on?
Well, first of all, it's my view that what you're doing in taking responsibility for your own medical care is what you should be doing. You wouldn't buy an appliance if you didn't know something about it. You wouldn't buy certain kinds of other consumer goods without knowing a lot about it. And I think you have to look at medicine exactly the same way. You have to know a lot more about medicine than you really want to. But aside from that, I think there's some guidelines that people can follow with respect to their association with their doctors. Certainly, if a doctor wants you to be involved in a clinical trial that you're not so sure about, you should ask another doctor. If your doctor is recommending expensive tests, too many X-rays of some kind, too many an additional cardiac catheterization, or some other expensive procedure, you need to get another opinion about that. And I think that in some circumstances it wouldn't be inappropriate to ask the doctor how he is reimbursed for his services.
Hmm. Also, it depends frequently on your doctor and partly how you're situated. I mean, someone like myself, I'm quite demanding of my doctor, and he seems to be okay with it. But some doctors don't like being questioned.
Yeah, and then find another doctor.
Yeah, it's probably that simple, right? If someone let's go back to I was thinking of something you said earlier when we first began discussing your book On the Take. And that is, you said a small percentage of doctors are involved in this. Is there any way to statistically put any figures on this? Is how many doctors really are complicit with big business and are endangering our health?
Well, all we have is spotty information from lectures that doctors give where they're required to disclose their conflicts, and from medical journals. We have some surveys that were done by my colleagues at Harvard and at Yale, in which it turns out of the academic group, about a quarter of them are have major involvements with industry. We also have the statement from the Washington Legal Foundation, which is a legal group that defends the drug industry, and their statement, I think, was really astonishing. They said, I have a quote right here. They say, how does it go here?
You look for it. I'll reintroduce the book, On the Take, How Medicine's Complicity with Big Business Can Endanger Your Health. On the Peter Werby Show, my guest is Jerome P. Kasirer, and it's published by Oxford Press. I'll have that link to it on my website as well.
I also have a website, by the way.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
It's onthetake.net.
Okay, I'll put that one on.
But here's the quote. They say, it's widely acknowledged that most of the top medical authorities in this country and virtually all of the top speakers on medical topics are employed in some capacity by one or more of the country's pharmaceutical companies.
So they don't make any secret about it, because you have a chapter in your book called Influenced by Gifts, Not I.
Right.
So
right.
Certainly no one's going to say, wow, this is corrupting medicine, this is influencing, overly influencing, or my attempt is not to over-influence other doctors to prescribe this. But there must be actually a drive to get in on this money.
Yes, and that's the sad part of it. Especially, you have young investigators, young researchers, who are getting their money from drug companies, and in some way, this forces them to do the kind of work that they would prefer not to do. but they can kind of have to do that because their projects are forced in that direction. I had one particular example where a young person had joined the faculty of a medical school and was expecting to do her own work, and it turned out that she was required to do some of the work of the pharmaceutical company that supported her position.
Well, that, you know, what's the old phrase? He who pays the piper calls the tune. Your last chapter in On the Take is What Can Be Done. I mentioned in our industry, the Federal Communications Commission. Is there any way, or what avenue should we be looking at to stop these practices?
Well, I would like to give the profession one last chance. It's quite clear to me that it's not moving on these issues, and I think it needs to move on the issues, and certainly things can be done. For example, committees that make a clinical policy, I think, should not have people on them who are conflicted. I think that major medical organizations, such as the American Heart Association, the American Medical Association, should not be led by people who have conflicts of interest with industry. And I think that doctors should stop taking meals and trinkets and pens and cups and whatever it is from drug companies. I think that that needs to stop. If that doesn't need, if that doesn't happen, then I think sooner or later the government is going to step in.
Well, Dr. Jordan J. Cohen agrees with you. He's the president of the Association of American Medical Colleges, and he says public outrage at the unconscionable practices documented in this book may be our only hope of redirecting the medical profession away from overweening self-interest and back towards its moral purpose, protecting patients' interests. My guest on the Peter Werbe Show, Jerome P. Kasserer, he's the author of On the Take, How Medicine's Complicity with Big Business Can Endanger Your Health. You can go on to onthetake.net. That'll be on my website as well, peterwerbe.com. Dr. Kasserer, thanks for spending the time with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Peter. Anytime.
Thank you for tuning in to the Riffs Night Call. Night Call is a public affairs presentation of 101 WRIF Detroit. The opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of the management or sponsors of WRIF Radio or Greater Media Detroit. Night Call is hosted every Sunday night by Peter Werbe. Now stay tuned for more Riff Rock, coming right up on 101 WRIF Detroit.
King Henry, why are you looking so sad?
My fourth wife is making my life miserable. I was thinking of having her beheaded like I did the others, but these new women's rights groups are giving me a very hard time.
Today, there's a better way to end your marriage. Simply call Adam. Adam is the American Divorce Association for Men. Let Adam take the misery out of your divorce while they protect the rights of men.
Your Highness, the Queen requests an audience with you.
Okay, show her in.
Hello, Henry, my dear. I understand you've hired Adam to handle your divorce.
That's right.
Well, why don't you come up to my chamber tonight and perhaps we could bury the hatchet,
You don't have to lose your home, your children, or your money in a divorce. Call Adam, the American Divorce Association for Men. They answer your questions about divorce at no charge. Call 248-356-ADAM.
Hi, I'm David Hall with an example of a late-night email from rockfinancial.com. Mike from West Bloomfield heard about the SmartArm 3 years ago, and here's what happened to him. He was buying a car and needed $20,000, so he decided to refinance instead of getting a new loan. So when Mike refinanced with the SmartArm to take out the cash to get the new car, his payment actually went down by $300 a month. So he added the money he was going to purchase the car for to his loan, and his payment went down by $300 a month. The interest rate on the SmartArm really drove his payment down. So 3 years later, all the principal is paid off, and the payment is still lower than it was 3 years ago, and he paid off the car. What a great story from rockfinancial.com. We get emails every day and every night, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You can get help at rockfinancial.com. Go right now. rockfinancial.com.
Rock Financial is a Quicken Loans company, an equal housing lender. 24/7 you'll have access to mortgage calculators, great information, and more at rockfinancial.com.
At KFC, we know how you feel about Mondays. Nobody likes Mondays, so we made Tuesday tastier. Now every Tuesday, get a country fried steak meal for just $1.99. That's right, a KFC country fried steak meal for just $1.99. Treat yourself to Southern-style country fried steak smothered in our special recipe white pepper gravy, served with mashed potatoes, coleslaw, and our famous buttermilk biscuit. All that great food for just $1.99 every Tuesday. A deal this good can only happen once a week, and since nobody likes Mondays, we make Tuesdays tastier. Hey, with this $1.99 meal deal, maybe Tuesday should be called Less Than Tuesday. Get it? $1.99 Less Than Tuesday? KFC's Country Fried Steak Meal with gravy, mashed potatoes, coleslaw, and a biscuit for just $1.99 this Tuesday and every Tuesday. Only at Kentucky Fried Chicken, Chicken Capital USA. Tax extra, only at participating KFC locations.
With Tiny Tim. Next.
Okay, so my friend Jerry has his Harley that he takes really, 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 really good care of. Almost too good care, if you know what I mean.
I love you. Yes, I do. I'm gonna rub your tag. Yes, I am, you cutie. Yeah.
So Jerry takes his motorcycle everywhere, drove a ton of miles, and wore down the tires.
Oh, no, Schmoofy, you're going bald. We gotta get you some new tires right away.
So Jerry takes his motorcycle to Motown Harley Davidson and Taylor's, where they're having a 50% off tire sale when you have them installed at Motown.
No, 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 sweetie. Those new tires don't make your rear suspension look big, and the price is so good. We're going to get you 2 cents because I love you, and you're so pretty. I won't kiss you right on the mouth.
For sales, specials, events, or just to look at cool pictures, log on to MotownHarley.com. Motown Harley Davidson in Taylor on Telegraph just north of Eureka.
Remember, guys, chicks dig a guy on a real motorcycle.
Buy or sell your bike at Motown.
Okay.
The station that gets you back to the Riff Rock quicker.
Well, there you have it.
101 WRIS.
This is it. Don't get scared now.
Riff
Rocks. Hi, this is Ryan from Nickelback, and you're rocking with 101 WRIS. If it rocks, it's on the Riff.
Can't get much clearer.